We call this meeting to order. Today is Monday, November 15th, 2021, and this is the business session of the Elizabeth School District Board of Directors, and it is 6:01 p.m. Can we get roll call, please?
Director Benninger?
Here.
Director Frumpeller?
Here.
Director Haynes?
Here.
Director Kircher?
Here.
Director Olson?
Here.
Would you please stand and join me in the pledge of allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Sure. No, I don't want to. Okay, so we're going to start out with outgoing board member recognition. We'll start with Douglas.
Okay. Well, we want to present these two tokens of appreciation, the district and staff, parents, everyone. So this says, with our sincere appreciation, we can represent you with this plaque in recognition of your 9 years?
8 and a half, close enough.
Okay. of dedication and commitment to the Elizabeth School District. Thank you. And then also for the few volunteers for your 4 years. And then we also have an additional both. Carol's been board president for the last 4 years, which is added responsibility.
Yes, it is.
So, I'd like to start by thanking both of you sincerely on my behalf, but also on behalf of the staff and our parents. Students. It's hard to know the difference that you as board members make. You come to these meetings, you sign things, you approve things, but you make a tremendous difference to the community, to the schools, and so I see it as sometimes part of my job to help you see that, just to see what you normally and naturally can't see, and that leadership matters, and you guys have said that, and you have respected the leadership in the district, and you have supported us, and you have helped us, but your leadership has made a tremendous difference. And I would also like to include in some of the things that I want to say, recent board members, Dee Lindsay, Richard Smith, and John Gutenberg. Yes. Because the last 4 years, so Paul, you've been 4 years, and you, so I'm speaking to the last 4 years when all of these people have been on. The district has accomplished a lot, and I know there's a lot that you all are proud of, tangible things, but also intangible things, the culture, how things, how we've overcome challenges. I mean, incredibly low turnover, teacher turnover this year. In 2018, passing the millennial override. I mean, that's huge. That made a turn to corner in terms of getting out of the kind of dumps with regards to compensation for staff. The grants that we've had, the focus on student pathways, student career preparation, just the general creativity and innovation that's happening in the schools, the ability to both attract, retain, and to support quality leadership across the district. And it just, you know, we have our new director of safety. You know, Shane did a great job. Mike is already doing a doubly great job. I mean, and you'll meet him at the next board meeting, some of you. Some of you won't. But I can tell you that I appreciate, and the staff, and as oftentimes the teachers appreciate the respect that you have shown to them, to our students, to our parents, to our community, that you've listened to all voices, you've been respectful always, you've had a kind of inquiry, you know, questioning when you don't know things, trying to learn, especially in the last 2 years, you and John really taking that learning process seriously. And I think that it's respected by folks who do this for, this is professionally, or this is what we're trained to do. And so to know that you come in and you respect, you know, the credibility of probably, I would say at this point, one of the best CFOs in the state. We're fortunate to have Ron. And you know, Ron is going to shake his head modestly, but I think the best probably just retired. His name was Glenn Gustafson, but Glenn has tremendous respect for Ron. And, you know, there's probably a few others. I don't mean to put him above everyone else, but he's in that category of being respected outside of the district as well as inside the district. And he's, you know, I could say things like that about most every member of the leadership team. And so your understanding of the governance role, which isn't easy, it's not natural. It's there's nothing you can compare it to, and the only way to know it is to be in it. But you've really worked to understand it. You've worked to help support us in our operations role. And I know that all of you, and especially the two of you, have over the years had to make some sacrifices. Not like, oh, I made a sacrifice. Things that have been painful, things that have been difficult with time, the emotions, challenges, sorting out being a community member, a parent, you know, challenging issues. What do I do? How do I respond to this? And those things are hard. And you know, I've not been a board member, and so in some ways, I don't know why you guys do it. Especially when I see how hard it is. And I've seen board members for 19 years because I've been superintendent and worked with many board members. And with that history, I can say you guys have been awesome, and I really appreciate everything. And want to also thank, and we have at least one spouse in the audience, but to thank your spouses, because they've had...
For living with me.
They've had...
During all the hard times.
Yeah, you know, I call on a Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock, you know, or maybe even 6. It's like, and you know, okay, it's not a good time or whatever. And, you know, you respond to an email on a Sunday, and I know... How much you guys care about the district, how much you care about being good board members, and the challenges just of balancing, especially as parents, parent concerns versus board member concerns. And it's not easy work, but we appreciate everything that you put into it. And I think you should be proud of the results that you can look back on your 4 years, your 8.5 years, and the partnership you've developed even with folks that aren't here. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And there may be some other staff members that either now or maybe, I know Ken wanted to say something in his report, but...
Well, just as a member of the leadership team, I want to echo some of what Douglas said and thank all of you for being so supportive of Douglas, the leadership team, and in turn, our staff and our students. It made a big difference to me. I always felt very comfortable with you. You listened. You were open to our recommendations to you. You asked good questions. And you put your trust in us, which I think was the most important thing. And I've worked for a number of different city councils. You know, I've seen good ones and bad ones. And this was a great, great team of elected officials. And it really made a big difference for me. I came here, I wasn't sure how long I would be here. And I'm entering my 10th year here. And it's because of people like you. So thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
If I might as well add my 2 cents now instead of later. I want to piggyback on both of these as well. Mostly, you know, I came here from Southern California. Yes, I'm one of those people in California.
Been we like
I'm sorry.
You,
okay.
You guys are the good ones.
And in my previous district, you know, it was a bigger district, 18 schools, and, you know, working with the board there was not necessarily the easiest part of my job or the nicest part. And so I didn't know what to expect when I came here. And it's like I don't ever want to leave because of the people that have been here in this position and who have replaced previous, you know, I've been here, this is my start of my 8th year now. And so I hope that continues. I don't want to go anywhere. People ask me, that was one of the concerns that people had when I first started working. me, I was like, oh, this guy from a kind of big district, he's just going to come here and set me stuff. And that wasn't the case because of people like the board, like yourselves, but also people like my coworkers and Douglas, et cetera. And so I wanted to thank you as well for all the things that Douglas and Ken have thanked you for.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I hope for the district next.
Since everybody else is adding their 2 cents. So I just want to tell you, I just really appreciate everything that you've done. And understand this next statement that I make. You understand that I was with the city of Wheat Ridge, so I worked with the city council there. I was with the city of Draper in Utah, and so I worked with the city council there. And been here for a few years. And I just want to thank you for having a functional board, because that makes a big difference for everything in the district here.
Yes.
And that's kudos. Kudos leadership and everything else. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Awesome. All right. Well, okay, since everybody's in.
Go ahead.
I been on the board 4 years, and I ran with these two. And Carol has been a great mentor and a leader for me. I have learned so much over the last 4 years, and with everybody in this room. I mean, it's just amazing. I'm on boards, and I've been on boards where there was not that teamwork at all, and there was always fighting and arguing, and not always, but sometimes. And I really just love Carol's focus and Paul's focus and desire to make this district better and more successful every day. And I just really appreciate my personal relationship that I've developed with you guys too.
That's
awesome. I love it. And Carol, you know, I've got your number. Sorry, Greg.
She's going to block us.
No, Greg's going to block.
Yeah, Greg.
I apologize.
I am always here for you, so.
Thank you very much.
I go last.
You get to go last?
Yeah. I always do and everything. It's my job. Let the other board members talk first.
Douglas mentioned sacrifices and personal sacrifices, but I think we as a board have sacrificed many different, maybe not personal agendas, but personal wants that we wanted to see in the district, because it didn't reflect us as a board. This is not an individual position where you can bring in personal agendas and try to push through your specific idea. And I learned the hard way early on. I came in very athletics focused. I think it's no story to anybody that's here. That was my focus. My daughters were extremely involved. I have friends whose kids were extremely involved.
You are extremely involved.
I'm extremely involved.
Yeah.
So it goes without saying that that's where my passion lies. But you've got to step back and really just think about what is the greater good, not only for the board, but more importantly for the district, for the administration that Douglas has put together and, quite frankly, kept around. You look around the state and you look at administrative groups that are around the state, I would doubt there's few that have the tenure within a specific district that yours does. And that's a reflection of the great work the board does, but more importantly, the great work that the leaders on Douglas's team do. One of the things that people ask me, what do you guys do on the board? Well, we keep an eye on the leadership team, and we make sure that things are going the way we feel it should go. But at the end of the day, they aren't doing anything that I wouldn't recommend or we wouldn't recommend. They're doing everything perfectly. Look up on the board right here. We have the pathways listed out. It's fantastic. Things like the opportunities that are offered up. That wasn't anybody on the board. That wasn't anybody in the leadership group. It was the entire district. So I just hope that the incoming board will come together, work together, keep agendas out, and just really make sure that you allow this leadership team to do their job. We've got, and when I say leadership team, I don't mean just those in this room. I'm partial to high school because that's where my kids have been for the last while. We have one of the best principals I have ever been around in the high school. and by far the best athletic director we've ever been around in the high school. And those two alone are making a huge difference. But again, they formulated a leadership team there that is second to none. I'd be remiss in leaving out Regina. My daughter started here under her leadership, and here she is all these years later, and they still look fondly back on those times as well. So thank you for that. Lastly, Douglas, thank you for your leadership, your patience with me. Might have had a couple of contentious moments in the past, but we've always looked at it as in a professional manner, and I've always appreciated that of you. So thank you.
So, I just have to say, rock on.
No, I have so totally enjoyed getting to know all of you guys, and Rhonda, I wish I could work with you longer here, but it is what it is. But seeing you guys grow into your roles, because every new board member comes on not having a clue really what it's about. You really don't.
I second that.
It's a rush of information. It's overwhelming at first. And it's just been really fun to watch you guys grow in understanding the role of governance as opposed to a manager or hands-on. It's a governance role. And I'm going to echo what Paul said. We've worked hard to keep any outside agendas out of the board. And I'm really proud of that. I mean, I feel like in the last 8 years I was on the board, there was never any outside agendas brought in. And that's, I don't think that, you don't see that in every school district. And I know the new board will continue with that. And you guys will work hard to help them understand, and they'll work hard to continue keeping good staff on hand, because yes, that's how you chase staff away, is by letting that outside stuff come in. And I know you guys will keep that. You guys all out there, thank you so much, because everything I know from being a board member, I learned from all of y'all. And I know that you were there patiently answering questions, just a month. Talk as well as Paul did, but I echo what he said. But yeah, thank you for answering questions and always being there when any of us have questions. Nobody's ever, you know, I don't have time for you. We really, really appreciate it. And you guys are tremendous, and the fact that you guys all stay as long as you do is absolutely wonderful. And I've enjoyed working with everybody. So it's kind of bittersweet, because I'm all these spaces I'm going to miss. So I told Carrie I might cry. I'm going to try not to.
Have some M&Ms.
Yeah.
I'll have an M&M, and that'll make you feel better. Chocolate always makes you feel better. Remember that. Chocolate makes you feel better.
Were you looking at Craig? Were you looking at
Craig? No, I was looking at Heather and Craig. Oh. He knows.
He already knows.
He has stacks of
chocolate. That's my go-to.
I've got a bowl in every room.
So anyway, just thank you guys all for staying around with us and for everything you said. I appreciate it.
Okay. So. Yeah. He's so happy to have you off of one board.
Yeah.
How are you? We have cake, too, in addition to M&Ms.
Awesome.
So if anybody...
Do you want to take a break? We'll take a five-minute break.
5 minute break.
Yeah.
And then anybody that wants to leave can leave.
Are back in session at 6:29 p.m. So we are moving on to our educational showcase with Singing Hills Elementary. With Regina.
Thank you. So just a few things, you know, in talking about some things that are new in our school. So we had three new teachers. We added an assistant teacher in our preschool, and her name is Mary Flores. She's doing a great job. And then I have Raquel Adams, a new first grade teacher. And then I have Heather Killebrew, a new second grade teacher this year. We have a new health tech. We've kind of had some transition going on. Selena Pellis was our librarian, but health tech opened. So she applied for that, and she started today. So a little transition. And Tiffany Roberts, who has been one of our spin pairs, is now our librarian. So it's been good. They're kind of just, they're staying with the Singing Hills family. We're just staying together there. We have Sarah Bong, and we share her. She's a preschool special education teacher. We share her with Brian Creek. along with Kathy Elkins, who does speech. We've gotten two new SPED paraprofessionals, Julie Carruthers and Riley Nelson. We were added them on because we needed more support, so that was wonderful. We have Maya Torres, and she is part of our kitchen support. And then Nathan McMullen is helping out with Kids Club. So a few people have positions that opened and had some new stuff. Some new things this year, we were approved from the state, from CDE, to be part of the Dyslexia Pilot Program. And that's been exciting, a lot of new learning. Our staff, it's K through third grade, along with our SPED team, and along with Lori Burton, our reading specialist or support person. And so we've been taking classes since the summer. And they've done some teaching with a reading program, it's called PRI. And it goes along with our structured literacy. So a few years ago, we were also approved to be part of a state program of structured literacy, and we've continued with that. And what we have found in with the pilot program, what we found is our structured literacy actually is doing really good as far as what we need. And so we've used our ECRI learning that we've been having as a support piece, a structure of support. So that's been really good. It's been really busy and stressful. You know, something new on top of everything else that goes on in our school. But it's been good. So I think the staff has really enjoyed that. And then, of course, we have our pathways, our graduate profile up there. And what we've done is we've been paused. That's what we've been doing for a while for our school rules. And then we started last year. We kind of just tiptoed into 7 Habits of Healthy Kids. And one of the reasons we did that was because Running Creek, is doing Leader in Me. It's the same thing as the 7 Habits. And so we want to make sure that our kids and Running Creek kids, when they go to the middle school, they have some of that same language and really trying to support that transition over to the middle school. So what we've done is we've combined the three of them and how do they support each other, because we have the language that our kids already know of, the 7 Habits and the pause, and then, of course, adding the same language. And so we focus on one per month. And we recognize our coyote competencies is what we've been calling them. And we have our kids' names up, and we say their names on Fridays when they're showing whichever attribute, whether it be leadership or empathetic and collaborative. That's our most recent one. So that's been going well. We're continuing with our practices and traditions that we've had in the past and kind of show those to them. So our first day of school, and we got to be outside, and this is a tradition. We always line up outside, and the teachers have their signs up, and kids line up behind their teacher signs, and we march in. Our fifth grade, our school's leaders, they lead us into the school, and so we see some happy kids coming in over there. We had our back-to-school night. We had Rita's ice cream, and there was a huge line there. But we had some activities going on as far as scouts and the library, just sharing some things, as well as the back-to-school night was meant to go to classrooms, which our families did. But you see here on the ice cream, we made sure that we had time for our staff and for our parents to have that social time together. So in that picture, there are staff and parents, families there in that picture.
Yeah, I was there. It was a social event.
It was a social event.
That's great.
It was a really nice design, because sometimes the parent-teacher conferences are really focused on that teacher-parent interaction, and that definitely happened. But there was a lot of really, you could just see it. I mean, even some previous Singing Hills kids that were there, because they had younger siblings, and, you know, hello, Miss Montero, and parents connecting with each other, parents connecting just, you know, their previous year's teacher. It was a wonderful design, I thought.
Yeah, it worked out really nice, and I think the social part, that was the biggest part. It really was. They went in and they listened to the teachers to see what was going on, but that social piece, being in the hallways and having them, we made sure to make time for that, because we didn't get to have our parents in last year.
Right.
So it was really important for us to make sure our parents felt welcome back in school, that we are here for them, and we want to support everybody in our school community. I just added some pictures of our classes, and so these are a couple fourth grade classes, and of course our kids like to smile for the camera. But the other picture over here, I wanted to share that, because we work on having morning meetings, and it's that social emotional learning that we focus on. So we've been doing trauma informed care probably about 5 years now have been our focus. We've been working on restorative practices, and that's where if students have a conflict, instead of don't steal the pencil, why did you do that? You know, why do you think that wasn't a good idea? How do you think it made your friend feel? So really trying to talk them through the process instead of just a quick discipline action. And so that part of morning meetings is if something's happened in the classroom, that's a chance to talk to it. And all of our classes do it. It's been working out really nice. We have the fifth grade challenge with Running Creek, and it was so nice to have that back. And so you see both students, fifth grade, from both schools there. And it's organized through the high school. And so it's one of those ways we do something at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year to bring our fifth graders together as they transition into middle school, try to help them with that transition. So we have a couple of times throughout the year where we bring them together. And it's collaborative learning, building together, working together. That is the sole purpose of this. It's how to work together.
Can you say something, or you said it's organized by the high school, can you say a little bit about that part of it?
So the youth, I'm pretty sure you see high school students in there, so they organize all of the games and the activities, and they're actually teaching the kids how to do this. I don't know if any of your high schoolers have been part of that, but sort of that mentor piece of this is how you do it. They give them a problem, a puzzle to solve, and help them do it. They do it, but it's with the guidance of the high school.
I will say my daughter participates in that, and she looks forward to that every single year. And one of the highlights is getting the T-shirt signed by all the kids on their little team. And they come home just with a T-shirt full of nothing but names. It's super cute.
And what's great is at the end of the year, we have our field day, and that's another time where we have the high school's kids help us out. And so they run the games for our field day. And it's so nice to see the kids that have gone through. But it's great for our kids to see, this is something I could come back and do. Yeah. And it's always such a nice community. It's that piece bringing together. Along with that, homecoming week. So just a few, we do probably a little bit different days than the high school does. So we had our sports day there. We had dress up day. We had Disney day. And so the two little ones are preschoolers, because we make sure it's all preschool through fifth grade. We all participate in it. And then PJ Day, my little Rourke there brought his pillow for PJ Day. Then, of course, our last day on that Friday is always Wear Red Day, so we get ready for the parade. And, of course, our homecoming parade and our float. And we always have special people that are part of that.
Yeah. I see one.
I told Carrie, I said, there's two pictures of people you're related to. this year we usually do a monster mash in the school, but because we get a few hundred people, we thought it might be best to try to do something outside. So we did monster trunk or treat, and it was hugely successful. So we're trying to get a picture of it all. And so what happened, we did this over in our bus parking lot, and we had parents decorate their trunks and have games with them, different games, and then they gave out treats and little things to the kids. But we had parents dressed up and kids dressed up, and then you see the horse trailer over here. One of our families made a haunted house in that horse trailer.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So that was the highlight, and I will tell you, the kids loved it. And then we had some special guests come in our community, our emergency responders, and so we had Elizabeth Police Department, we had Elizabeth Fire Department, State Patrol, and Albert County Sheriff's Department, all coming along, and that's where you're sitting right, too. Yeah,
with the State Patrol.
Well, we got a call of, like, what is going on?
Yeah. Did you?
Because of all the emergency vehicles.
Oh,
that's right.
Greg asked that, too. He called me and said, what's going on
right?
at the school?
You remember that?
I drove
that
by.
You guys were all asking me, what's going on? It's like, it was trunk or treat.
It was trunk or treat, yeah, but it was nice. And it was a little windy at times, but it was a lot of fun. So we had all of our emergency responders in front of the school, because we had a photo booth inside the school, and, of course, at the bathrooms. If people needed them, but the kids had such a great time. I think the parents did. And so one of the parents, she walks her child to the front door every morning, and it's her little Kendi, and the little Kendi has to kiss the one that's a little bit younger, about 3 years old, and then baby. And they do this, it's their tradition. And so it's they always do this every morning. Well, they showed up there. They're like, hi, Miss Montero. I didn't, Mom had a black wig on. She was Waldo.
Oh.
I totally did not recognize her. I think that's them actually in that top picture. Hello, you know, because I'm thinking, okay, which parent is. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I didn't recognize you.
That's funny.
It was fun. Let's see. We had recently, this just ended on Friday, our food drive from our ambassadors, and it goes up to our Legion, our local post 82. So they actually just came and picked everything up. And we had, I'm trying to remember, 2,537 cans collected this year.
Wow.
So that was more than last year. So that was pretty good. We were pretty excited about that. And I got to see Richard today because he was the school collecting. And then most recently, Friday, we had a Veterans Day breakfast. And so just some pictures of some things that the kids did. To have our hallways decorated as our special guests came through. And this year we did a Veteran Stars Award. And so it was really neat, the top picture up here. This is one of our moms at our school. And this was her mother, and they were both there. And so that was really neat. And when they walked through, I said, look at our board, look at your pictures. So mom and grandma were very humbled and proud to be part of that. So that was really nice. And we put it out to our families if they wanted to do a star and decorate it. And everyone kind of just did on their own how they wanted to. And we'll keep that up through the month.
And if you haven't seen it, the Good News Bulletin has a video of the Veterans Day celebrations at all of the schools, and there's some video of these events at singing notes.
And then we had our scouts present the colors, and Scott Aubert directs our scouts, and it's PAC 747, and they did such a nice job. We're so proud of them. They did so good. And then we had Mr. Cam Packus there, and he led our fourth grade in the national anthem, and then he led our fifth grade in America the Beautiful. Then you kind of see in the background a couple of the staff members that helped out with breakfast over there. So we have Lisa Peugeot and Shelby Morgan. They make the breakfast burritos the night before with Tamara Morgan, who is our kitchen lead. And so they do such a nice job. And then just some of our guests. The pictures that I showed you, that's this family right here of mom and grandma and that one. And then over here, just another family, real sweet family. Everyone has something that they go through, and this little family's been through a lot recently. So it's a sweet family. That's grandpa and his two little ones. And then just some other guests. And if you look close, you might find some just district personnel in that one. But so we had just some different people that came to attend. You see some of the kids. Of course, we let our guests bring their children in for breakfast. Are you looking for our table?
Yeah. So I'm not a vet, but I was the chauffeur for an 89-year-old Korean War vet. So
fantastic. Good for you.
Cool. He was there. And the gentleman sitting to my right is our transportation director. Believe it or not, he was recruiting for bus drivers there.
He was a trudy.
Among the adults?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Among the military retirees, he was
recruiting. Wow, good for him.
And I'm not kidding about that. He really was.
The grandpa that was in that picture, they happened to be sitting next to each other. He was trying to get him on.
That's
funny. He says, I already drive the bus for these two. And then we have Jason, and then we have our executive director, okay. Mike, who is a veteran.
Very nice.
So it was very nice.
Very cool.
People were very happy and pleased that we had it. And we had some folks from the Legion. Mr. Miranda Stan came, and he's come every year that we've done this, which I think is the 11 years I've been there. So he came up and he asked about a student that our fourth grade ambassadors greet all of our veterans, our guests that come in. And so this year they greeted them at the front, and then they escorted them to the cafeteria. But they also talk to our guests, and they ask them questions. Well, Stan made friends with one of our little kiddos, and they just had this connection. And she was so intrigued by his answers about the war he had been in. He came back a couple weeks later, this is a few years ago, and brought her a little gift to help remember the conversation. Oh, well, they ended up over COVID meeting her family and everything. So as he's leaving, he goes, do you think I could go see Ava? And I said, well, she's in middle school now. Oh, because it's been a few years. And he goes, do you think I could go there? I said, let me make some phone calls, and I think it would be okay. So first I called Ava's mom and asked her if it was like, oh, yes, yes, we met Stan, and Stan knows our family. I'm very comfortable with him saying, well, then I called the middle school. Hey, just want to let you know. And I said, I do have permission from mom unless she wanted. And they go, oh, but she's not here today. And mom, you know, so told me that. So, but mom gave her permission to.
Oh,
nice.
That's good.
So that's just, that was recently. That was on Friday. But if I could also thank you both, Carol and Paul, for your support. Your time and dedication, because I have two parents that have been board members cumulatively about 20 years. So I know the time it takes away from family. Now, of course, I was out of the house, but I did have a little brother that was still home during this time, and a sister that was down there and worked for the district at the time, still does. And my mom's now on her second round, Carol, of 8, so she did 8 years. And then my dad did 8 years, and now my mom's back on, working on her fourth, you know, getting in there. So,
wow.
So I do understand everything, the sacrifices that you make for your families, and I do know everything that you do here, because, you know, at the family dinners, Thanksgiving and Christmas, we get to hear about what's going on. And then my mom will ask me, well, what are you guys doing? It's Trinidad is a smaller district like we are, and so I will share something with her. Well, can I have a superintendent here? Call your superintendent. Sure. And then I tell this and say, I want to let you know, your dad might call you. I told my mom what you're doing. So that's kind of what happens. I don't know if he's gotten a call yet, but I do appreciate, and well, on behalf of Singing Hills, our family there, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well,
thank you for all your work at
this
school.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Any questions?
It was awesome. Thank you.
That was
thank
great.
You. Very
thank
good
you.
Presentation.
I'm so glad I got to meet you.
I know, I got to see one more.
Yes.
Thank you, Regina. Okay, so we'll move on to the approval of the agenda. Can I get a motion to approve the amended agenda, and it is amended to include an action item, revised district calendar?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? Roll call, please.
Director Beckendar.
Thank you.
Yes.
Director Crumpfellers?
Yes.
Director Hines?
Aye.
Director Carter?
Aye.
Director Olson?
Yes. Can I get a motion to approve the minutes from the board meeting of October 25th, 2021?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? Roll call, please.
Director Beckendorf?
Yes.
Director Crumpfeller?
Yes.
Director Hines?
Aye.
Director Carter?
Aye.
Director Olson?
Yes. Okay, moving on to communications. We have our auditor presentation for fiscal year 2022-2021. You're welcome to come sit at the table with us.
You're
okay.
On the hot seat.
Rather stand behind the podium?
Or either one, whichever you prefer.
Give me the hot spotlight.
Yeah, I think we'll be turning that off, hopefully. Is that going to go on?
I'm not turning it off because we're going to use it.
Oh, okay.
I think we have problems.
Fine.
Okay. Yeah,
just gives you a backdrop.
If you want to stand at the podium,
I want
you're
the berry and the salmon behind me.
Oh, yeah.
If it's easier for you at the podium, that's fine, too.
No,
whatever's the best for you.
Thank you very much. My name is Jim Hinkle with Hinkle & Company CPAs, and we perform the annual audit of the financial statements this year. We begin our audit by updating our understanding of the school district's internal accounting controls to determine the adequacy of those controls. Primarily, we're looking at a segregation of duties. An accounting transaction typically takes 3 steps: initiation, approval, and reporting within the company's books and records. And we want to make sure that not one person does all 3 of those steps, that there's multiple people in that process as checks and balances. We also then look at the control features, the approval process, the account coding, things of that nature. We randomly select disbursements and payroll transactions, and then we verify that the control features are operating as intended and that we as auditors can rely upon those. We do that through the statistical sampling. That process allows us to do two things. The first thing it does is allows us to determine if there are any significant deficiencies or material weaknesses in the internal controls. Now, those are terms of art for us. A significant deficiency is a design flaw in the system of internal controls that would allow an error to go undetected in the ordinary course of business. And a material weakness would be a significant deficiency that could result in a material misstatement of the financial statements. And based upon our understanding of the internal controls and our testing of the control features, we did not find any significant deficiencies or material weaknesses in internal controls. That's the answer that you want to hear.
Yes.
The second thing that all that work does is allows us to design what we call our audit risks associated with the audit and design our tests on the actual financial statements. And we primarily use substantive testing, which is test the details and analytic review. Test the details is exactly what it sounds like. We drill down into account balances and we verify the underlying transactions with supporting documentation, may that be contracts, invoices, or other types of source documentation. And then analytic review is where we take the current year's revenues and expenses to prior years, current years to budget, certain balance sheet accounts to revenues and expenses, and we're looking at relationships that we either wouldn't expect or can't explain. And if we do find any of those, then we do more tested details on those specific accounts. And the end result of that work is our opinion on the financial statements. And the opinion on this is an unmodified opinion, which in layman's term is a clean opinion. States that the financial statements are prepared in accordance with general accepted accounting principles and applied on a basis consistent with the prior year. And that's also what you want to hear. Due to the federal awards that the district received, we also were required to do a single audit. And that basically means that back before 1984, we would come out and audit the financial statements, and then all the various federal department auditors would come out and audit their individual grants, and you'd have auditors in and here out all day long. And so Congress passed a law that said the external auditors are going to do one audit, one single audit, that does the financial statement audit and verification of compliance with federal awards, and that's what the single audit is. We tested the coronavirus relief funds, which is a new program basically with everybody at this point. And we issued two opinions associated with the single audit package. The first one is in compliance with government auditing standards, and it basically looks at, does the school district have the internal control structure to be able to identify what federal programs it receives money under, what the compliance requirements are, and allows the district to have the compliance so that there aren't any issues of non-compliance. And we're looking at overall federal awards. And that opinion is an unmodified opinion. It states that the district does have the internal control structure to identify the programs it participates in and the requirements, and that we did not find any instances of non-compliance in any of our audit procedures on any audit program. The second is a report on what we call in reference to uniform guidance, and that's where we, under the uniform guidance of the federal code, select a specific program to audit, and that's the coronavirus. And there we look at that program only. Did the district have the internal controls in place to ensure compliance with that program? And then we do statistical sampling for the actual expenditures on that program, and we test the individual compliance requirements for that program. And that one also is an unmodified opinion. So we found that the district did have the internal control structure in place for the new program, the Corona Relief Program, and that through all of our testing on all of the compliance requirements for that program, we did not find any instances of non-compliance. So that, again, is what you want to hear. So we had a clean report across the board on all three audit reports that we issued. The financial statements, I'm sure you all have a chance to look at page by page. There really is probably two primary differences, if you will, from what we've had in the last couple of years. We had a reduction in the PPR payment through the state because of their reaction to the pandemic. As a result, we did have a decrease in fund balance in the general fund, slight one. That should respond back positively this coming the current year as the state has found they have a windfall of money through the federal grant monies as well as their sales tax money didn't drop as much as they thought it would. So the PPR is actually going back up by more than it reduced. So that ought to help there. And then the second big difference from the previous year is the PARA program, the retirement program that we have to put on the government-wide statements. Two things occurred there. One is the state did not make their annual contribution that they committed to just about a year and a half ago because they were afraid that they would run short of money with the pandemic, which did not happen. So it's anticipated that they'll come back with that again in the future years. In the past, they made a $125 million contribution to the four PARA trust funds. And secondly, we did not have any substantial changes to the assumptions within the PARA, such as investment return and experience. And so we did not see the dramatic changes that we have had in the past that affect the financial statements of the district and everyone else. So those types of things were fairly consistent from the previous year, which is, makes it a little bit easier to review the financial statements when we don't have these gyrations going through that we have no control over whatsoever. Those are the real two big changes from the financial statements from the previous couple of years. And those are really both pandemic-related type impacts. Once we issue our final report, we will issue a letter called a required communication letter, which we're required by our standards to communicate if certain events occurred during the course of the audit, and we have nothing to report that will be in that letter. We did not have any disagreements with management. We did not have any difficulties during the course of the audit. We did not have any past adjustments or errors to account balances that we found that we did not adjust the financial statements for because they weren't large enough. We didn't have any of those. And then oddly enough, we are required to tell you that we did not become aware of management talking with other auditors. That goes back to the old opinion shopping days, that if we disagreed with management on an accounting method that they were using, that they would just go talk to other auditors until they found one that agreed with them, and they would fire us and hire them. And we're required to communicate if we are aware of that or not. So all in all, it was a good, clean audit. Probably the most important thing that I would like to communicate to you all is that during the course of the audit, we felt like we had open transparency in that everything that we asked for, we received in a reasonable period of time, and we never felt like we were kept from anything in order for us to perform whatever procedures we felt were necessary for us to meet our professional standards. So we felt like we had that open transparency communication, that we were able to ask whatever questions we needed to and request whatever documentation we needed to. So all in all, Ron, thank you very much. It has been a different environment through the pandemic, but we've all been able to work through that in the last year and a half. And would like to say thank you to your staff as well. We realize that we are an interruption to your daily lives, an additional workload, and so thank you to your group being very responsive to us and getting everything that we needed and be able to conclude the audit in the fashion we have. So thank you very much. So all in all, it's a good report, and the audit went smooth, and upon your approval, I think that will be final, and then we're off for another year. Are there any questions?
Yeah, the $125 million that the state held back the contribution of PARA, they're going to, you think they'll reinstate that in subsequent years?
Yeah, they're not going to go back and do
they're
that.
They're not going to go back. No. Okay. Well, then.
That I've not heard of that. I don't know if you have, but I... No. They just suspended it. You know, what they did was, gosh, 2 years ago, they committed to fund what it takes to become, quote, fully funded, which is really only 80% funded, in a 30-year period. Am I remembering that right?
30-year.
And so that was determined every year. It may change, you know, to something more or something less. I will note that in here, your proportionate share of the pension liability did decrease a little bit, primarily because of the investment rate of return. The actual has been greater than what they assumed, because the market's done really well this last year. And so that's been a positive effect. But no, I don't believe at all for a moment that they would go back and make that up, but they will reinstate that contribution going forward. You know, what's interesting, we audited a lot of municipalities as well, and most did not see a reduction in any of their revenue. Where they lost sales tax in small businesses, they picked it back up in big box sales tax or online sales tax. And so the state with income tax and sales tax, a lot of municipalities with the sales tax and property taxes, really did not have the decline in revenues that was feared at the beginning of the pandemic, and that includes the state. So they've got all the federal American Relief Act monies and whatnot, where they've actually got pretty good of a windfall right now at the state level. So, any other questions? Nope. Ron, do you have anything to add that I missed or anything?
I just want to say thanks for your patience. One of the unique things, not unique things, but receivables or unique things for this year related to the coronavirus monies. We've had five, maybe six, different streams of coronavirus relief fund types of monies. The CRF money, ESSER 1, 2, 3, and then GEAR. And we got final approval for ESSER 2 right around the time of, right around the end of the fiscal year. So what that meant was the, I think it's about, $400,000 or $500,000 that we got from ESSER 2. We spent most of that money in the previous fiscal year, but we didn't actually have approval for it, because you can go back for previous expenses and put it on your application and you can get reimbursed for it. Well, we spent a bunch of money in the previous fiscal year. We didn't know if we were going to get 100% reimbursement. We got 100% reimbursement, but we didn't get the money. We requested the money early on in the summer before the end of July, but we didn't get it until I think it was October, and that's unusual that we would put a receivable on our books and count it as a revenue for the previous fiscal year when we didn't receive it until 4 months after the close. And so I know that might have held you back, and I don't know if it did, and I apologize if it did, but in my opinion, it should go back, it should be reflected as a receivable on the books for the previous year, and then also be actually reflected as a revenue for the previous fiscal year. And I'm glad that you were patient enough to wait until we got it, because the federal government is really slow.
And that matches the matching concept with the revenues and expenses. We've seen that in other areas with nonprofits as well as governmental entities, that the federal government has just been tremendously slow in those approval processes. And in many of that cases, they are more overwhelmed than many of us are with all this grant money and the new programs and all that, and they're way behind in that approval process. So we've seen that all across the board in a lot of places. So, but we're here, we got through it, and we're in good shape, so you're welcome.
Oh, and as you're going to find out, we use lots of acronyms in school districts. And PPR, what Jim mentioned, is per pupil revenue. And so it went down from 1 year to the next because of the coronavirus and the anticipated reduction in revenues at the state level. And so that's why, you know, Jim made the comment that it was related to the PPR reduction, that our fund balance went down. So,
and that should be made back up, actually, pretty much this year with the increase in the PPR that that the state's doing. Any other questions? Right.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you for allowing me 10 minutes or so to step in your meeting and discuss the audit process. And enjoy getting back to a in-person meeting.
Yep, exactly.
So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming down. Next up, we have our HR update with Ken.
Hello again.
Hello.
Last time. You know, last time I met with you in October, we were in the throes of bringing on some new staff members, and I just wanted to kind of let everybody know, including the two new board members, kind of who they are. And so, as Doug has said, Mike Newton has started, our Director of School Safety and Emergency Planning, and, you know, I think Shane really set up this program and did a lot while he was here, and I think Mike's the kind of guy that's going to take us to the next level. Very enthusiastic. He's all over the place, meeting people, meeting with principals at the schools a lot. So I think we struck gold there. I'm really confident that he's going to do really well for us. Carrie Freisenegger is our new certified nursing assistant instructor over at the high school. She's part-time. As Douglas may have said before to you, that we normally have health technicians that report to our district nurse, but we've hired a part-time nurse for the high school after COVID and everything that's come along with that and some needs at the high school. And it's Brooke Newton, who's Mike Newton's wife. And they're both Elizabeth residents, so that's really great. And they're both great people, and so I think we're looking really good there.
Ken?
Yes?
Will she be teaching the CNA course, or is that separate?
Separate.
Yeah, so the one before Brooke.
Yes, Carrie.
Oh.
Carrie.
Oh, okay.
Is the part-time. So they're both part-time.
Mm-hmm.
They're both doing kind of nurse-related work. But Carrie is a teacher in the CNA program, the Certified Nurse Assistant Program.
Right.
It's beginning in January.
Okay.
In a modular that you may have seen that's
yes.
being installed right now. None of us knew how much work it was to install a modular, but we're learning. and so she's qualified and been hired to do that. And beginning the work now, she actually has been doing the work for a couple of weeks to build, you know, the supplies, the curriculum, all the approvals. We're still in the process of getting it approved mm-hmm. from the state because we're offering the CNA.
Right.
It's not through somebody else. We're offering it. So she's doing that, and Brooke's the part-time nurse, but she will be able to do things like IEPs, 504s,
great.
Work with the counselors that the health techs can't do. In addition to substituting for Lauren when she's out of the district, which she's been for the past few days, so it's been great. You know, she was on the job 2 days, and it was like, okay, now. And so she's been getting all the calls from staff and families about COVID and having to answer them. And she can do that in a much more informed way than any of our health techs because she just has more training and experience.
We've gained some real flexibility with these two experienced people coming on. And so that's really, I think, going to be another plus for us. Interestingly, we've had two teachers that we recently hired mid-year for the middle school. And interestingly, one of them is a 7th grade social studies teacher. We lost our 7th grade social studies teacher mid-year. And this 7th grade social studies teacher that we're bringing on, her name is Ashley Keith, and she's a nurse. Do you know her? Yeah. And so she... she's going through an alternative licensure program and will be our 7th grade social studies teacher at the high school. She's great. I've met
good
her.
Deal.
She's
yep.
really good.
She's really good.
Really enthusiastic. And then...
Can I just add, she's also an Elizabeth alumni.
Yes, she is.
Yes. Yes, she is. Thanks for adding that. And then we've been looking most of this semester for a special ed teacher. They're hard enough to find... Normally, they're hard enough to find and to hire, but this was a mid-year hire for us, so Tracy Waters has started now as she's an experienced special ed teacher over at the middle school. All this has happened in the last several weeks, So we've had some really good results, and I'm really enthused about all these people. I think they'll be really good for the district, for the schools. You know, earlier I was thanking you from over there, but I wanted to give people a real, and you, a thank you for some real policies, some things that you allowed us to do that we recommended to you. And they had to do with pay. And recently you all agreed to increase our sub-teacher pay back to what I call our COVID rate. And I wanted to let you know that that has been very successful. We're filling virtually all of our sub-teacher positions. Thank you. And so it's worked out really, really well. We are equal to or higher in pay for our substitute teachers than any of our surrounding districts, and we're attracting some really good people that are coming back to us from some of these other districts. So thank you for that.
Can I just say that one of the reasons that's important is that when we can't attract quality subs, what we get is, I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but babysitters.
Yes.
Versus teachers. And when we can attract high-quality subs, what happens when there is a substitute is the students continue to progress with their learning.
Yeah.
And
that's been really successful for us, so thank you.
And are you going to mention the classroom?
Yeah. You mean the
that pay piece?
Yeah.
So you guys
didn't know where you're going.
I didn't know whether he was going to the next thing.
Just go whisper.
I think I know what he's talking about,
conference.
But I want to make sure.
It wasn't just teacher substitute pay, it was also classified, which we didn't increase during last year during COVID. And we did because it was very necessary.
Yes. That's all been very helpful to us.
Good.
Including what you did recently, where you you know what? I ate one of those little peanut things.
They're great.
Yeah.
You're not talking.
We asked you if we could increase the pay for our activity sponsors.
Yep.
Yes.
At the high school, at really all the schools, but mainly at the high school and the middle school. And you authorized that increase that put them more on a footing with how we pay our coaches, which we've made improvements to over the last few years. We've received, I've received a number of really great comments from our activity sponsors.
Great.
You know, sometimes we don't think about them, but they're out there after school, they're out there before school, they're out there on weekends, sponsoring clubs, different activities. Most of them are, they pretty much all are our current staff, many of them teachers, most of them teachers. And they put a lot of work into these clubs and these activities, and I want to let you know that they're very appreciative of the fact that you increased their pay and recognize their contributions. So I wanted to pass that on to you also.
Great.
And then finally, not a real important thing, but we're in the process right now of updating our employee handbook. This is the old one that we currently use. We're going to be updating that, and I'll make sure that everybody gets a copy. And I would encourage you to read through it. There's really good, you probably know a lot of this as a former employee of the district, Craig, but for both of you, there's really good information. It's what we give our employees when they come on, and there's really great information about employment with the district. So I'll make sure you all get one, and I'll send you two copies for Christmas.
Oh,
thank you
so much.
And that's all I have to say because I've got a peanut stuck in my throat.
Take that water with you.
I will, thank you. Any questions?
And if that doesn't work, try some cake.
Yeah,
wash it down.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank
you so much, Marty.
Excuse me.
Next up, we have Marty with our technology update.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
I wasn't here last time, so I haven't had a chance to address
Rhonda.
But also our new board members who officially will be addressing in the next couple of weeks. So I just thought I'd give you a general update. There hasn't been much going on except for just kind of maintenance and improvement in the district as far as technology goes. To kind of also give you an overview of our Chromebook 1-to-1 program, since some of you here in the room haven't heard this necessarily before. But so when we passed our MLO 3 years ago now, one of the things that came out of that was a budget for technology, And so we have put together a plan to go to one-to-one. One-to-one just means one computer per student. And we were going to do that grades 4th through 12th. And so we had an implementation, three to four-year implementation, along with some PD. And COVID came along, which was a silver lining because it provided with us with some funding to go one-to-one immediately, K through 12. And so since last August 2020, we've purchased about, I want to say, 1,300 or so Chromebooks for this purpose. We've also decommissioned about, I'd say, 500 Chromebooks, older Chromebooks. And so that also has been a help for us because when we did our purchasing, we wanted to make sure that the Chromebooks that we were purchasing, we could swap out parts for the Chromebooks that we were. So as an example, one of our biggest repair items are screens, broken screens. And so all of the decommissioned Chromebooks that that we have now, we are just cannibalizing those screens where usually they would cost anywhere between $50 to $80 per screen. Yeah. And so my repair budget has been a little bit low this year. Now, that's, you know, eventually that's going to go back up to, you know, previous levels, probably even more because we have a lot more Chromebooks than we ever have. But right now, it's great because it does free up some of that funding for other tech improvements. And so the other piece, too, that was an important piece of this was the professional development. If you remember, I had, like, a professional development plan where we can do a third of teachers every year, kind of build up support and build up capacity. And that all went out the window because of COVID, and we had to kind of do training on the fly, and a lot of teachers were forced to do some of the and use some of the tools that we were planning to train anyway, like Google Classroom and Nearpod, et cetera. And so I've taken a different approach and kind of modified the training piece to be more kind of a la carte and as needed. And then sort of talking to our staff, we're talking to the schools and say, hey, where's the support that you need for, you know, continue making our one-to-one program successful? And so that's been working out. Probably, I'd say, starting next year, I probably have a bit of a more formal plan again for us to follow over the next few years as we go along. So that's where we're at. We're at Chromebooks.
I want to remind everybody that one of the things that Marty insisted on with the purchase of the hardware and software was that the only way that it would be effective is with a comprehensive and robust training professional. Mm-hmm. That otherwise it could just sit there and use. But so that was really kind of something he insisted on in terms of if we're going to go down this path, we have to not just buy the stuff, but we have to help people use it. So that's gonna, that was a multi-year process. It still is a multi-year process. And so that's in part why he's bringing it up again. It got thwarted a bit because of COVID. It kind of the need shifted more towards immediate, how do you do remote instruction, synchronous, et cetera, different tools than you would might use just with in-person.
Right. And we were using, at one point, MindSpark Learning, which is a nonprofit organization that I've been partnered with in the past that does a lot of PD work. And so and so I haven't used them at all because, you know, that was a kind of targeted partnership with them to look out to your plan to say these are the types of trainings we're going to do with our teachers. And so I'll probably revisit that. And plus, they haven't done PD in person. You know, I don't know that they're still, I think they just moved back to in-person PD work. And so I'll be looking through them again to see what type of options we have and what kind of planning can we do for our teachers. The other thing, then, is just is maintaining and improving in terms of our technology in the district. You know, always trying to maintain our network. A few years ago, we had gone to 1 gigabit network speed for the internet. If you guys remember my explanation then, we were like at a 2-lane highway. Yeah. We went to a 10-lane highway, right, in terms of speed. And so just this past year, we went now to a 20-lane highway. I don't take the highways anymore, so I'm not contributing to those. You know, I take back roads. And so that sets us up to be a pretty good position in the future. I don't know that we'll need to do any type of upgrade for that, you know, in the next 3-4 years, but you never know. what kind of technology is going to be out there that's available for our students. And then we're just looking at different types of things to make our work easier. If you remember, I mentioned to you, we went to a new work order system this past fall. It's been working great for us. It's helped us a lot better in terms of being able to, one of the features of that was to be able to track where our Chromebooks are per student, but we didn't have that ability before. It works and integrates with Infinite Campus, which is our student information system where all of our student information is kept. So that's been a great tool for us. We're looking at other options for a single sign-on. If you don't know what single sign-on is, it's just a way for students and parents to be able to get to what they need to get to via one login and one portal. So instead of like, oh, you have to go to Nearpod and log in there to do your Nearpod, you have to go to Google Classroom and log in there to do Google Classroom, now you have to log in here. It's like one place, one-stop shop. They log in once, and then they have like a panel that shows all the different things that they're, you know, addressed. And so we're looking into that now. One of the benefits, through a company called Clever, which actually provides their software for free. We're looking at that, and a lot of districts use them. And so we're looking at that, and the other important piece that Clever also does is rostering. So there's a lot of data that gets transferred back and forth in a lot of these external systems, like student information, like for any of our, like for example, Running Creek is using iReady for their assessment, their day-to-day assessments, and so student information has to get into iReady. And so that's always been a manual process for one of my staff to try to do and get in there. A lot of times these vendors have built-in tools to be able to interact, but sometimes they don't. Clever is one of those tools that partner with a lot of these companies, and it'll just make our lives a lot easier because now we can roster a lot of these external systems through the company called Clever. So we're putting that, we're going to pilot with a couple of K-5 teachers this coming second semester to see if it's something that we want to then extend in the future for K-5. It seems to be that, in terms of when I'm talking to my tech committee, that it's more of a tool maybe for K-5 students, not necessarily for, and maybe middle school, not necessarily for high school, but we'll see how that goes. And then the last thing is to let you know, I don't know if you've already heard that we're hosting a robotics event this Saturday. Did you guys know that?
No.
So Ashley Pollard, who's a teacher at the high school, she is the tournament director. So we're having a first Lego League tournament qualifying event. So first Lego League is for children ages 9 to 14, so usually fifth graders and middle school. So we're going to have a bunch of schools from around Colorado come to Elizabeth this Saturday. I'm volunteering. I'll be a scorekeeper. I was able to recruit my nephew, who is a high school robot on a robotics team at Coronado High School in Colorado Springs. So he's going to be a referee, and I think some of his teammates have also volunteered. So if you have some free time, I believe the official competition starts at noon this Saturday. It's free to the public. You guys can come, and it's going to be in the gym, mostly in the gym. You can come and check it out and watch the kids do. So what they do, if you don't know, if you're not familiar with these events, they have a certain set of things that they have to do. So they have some sort of robotics. Usually this is through Lego, so they use usually Mindstorm is a type of Lego robotics. But they would have to, they get a certain set of instructions that they have to then program their robotics to do. You know, they have to go down this way, they have to pick up items, they have to drop them in the right place, they get scored, and so there's a whole competition. Yes. And so that's happening this Saturday at the high school. It's happening all day. I believe the official competition starts around me, if you're interested in coming. Other than that, or I think there's a craft fair too at the middle school.
But there is. Yeah. Is there a new craft fair?
Yeah. Artie, do the board members see the EHS event calendar?
Probably not. They probably need to, but they can. That's on. If that's a public calendar, then it should be part of the.
Because I've been adding all the events to that, mainly for you guys. But I realize you didn't see it.
So not necessarily in Google, but certainly because that all goes to the website.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So off the website, you're going to.
It's on the main district page.
Yeah, it's the high school website. Are you talking about the main?
No, the main.
Our ESD?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's off of our main district page, the calendar there. So, any questions for me?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marty.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, Chief Financial Officer, Ron.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Checks over $5,000. So, normal expenditures such as food supplies, fuel, utilities, workers' comp, charter flow through, plus the following. Additionally, there are payments for some outside SPED services, out-of-district tuition for SPED student, technology hardware, employee moving expenses, consultant services related to the gear grant, a couple of reimbursements to another district related to the gear grant, VOTEC tuition, athletic software, and equipment for FCCLA. Any questions regarding any of the...
What is the equipment reimbursement for Elbert County listed there?
So
I saw two line items.
Right. So when the district put in for the gear grant, it was a consortium of five districts?
Six.
Six districts? Gear grant. Gear slash Rise.
Oh, Rise?
Four.
Oh.
Elbert, Big Sandy, and...
I was thinking of the one that included Cherry Creek as well. That was a different
one. Yes, that's the sync-up grant.
That's it.
Isn't it fun?
It is.
To get your grants confused because we have so many now.
So many, yeah.
It's a good problem to have.
Yeah, that's a good thing to do.
It's all in your perspective.
It's true.
Job security, Ron. Job security.
Okay, sure. Okay. So, in other words, Elbert School District spent some money, and that was part of the grant.
Oh, okay.
Originally part of the grant, and since we're the ones, the fiscal, I don't know what you call it.
Record keeper.
The fiscal service record keeper.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have to request the money, or they send us, they spend the money, the district spends the money, and once they spend the money, they send us the invoice,
we make
a request to the state, it has to run through our books as a revenue, and then it has to run through our books as an expense.
Okay.
And it's reimbursing.
That makes sense, thank you. So,
sure.
Okay. But it is a lot of money, because the grant's, over $500,000?
Yeah, and those numbers weren't small.
No, they're not small.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but that's why I didn't know, because I also saw buses on there from El Paso County.
Right, yeah,
and we bought them. I was like, oh, is this bus related here, too?
Yeah.
So, okay.
No, that's a little bit different.
Great.
Yeah, the buses were from Falcon.
Got it. Thank you.
Sure. Anything else?
No.
Okay, financial statements. These statements reflect financial activity through the end of September or 25% through the fiscal year. Revenues after allocation to the charter school are at 16.42% as a percentage of the general fund budget, while expenditures are at a little bit over 24%. There are several cost centers over the 25% benchmark, but some are due to large one-time expenditures, such as insurance premiums, or expenses that are going to actually be reflected as expenses for the previous year. But since these are on a cash basis, these are reflected in our financial statements at this point in time. And also, there are some that were due to some large capital projects that were completed earlier in the fiscal year. Any questions on the financial statements? Next up is the mid-year budget revision that's going to be coming up on January 24th. And that mid-year budget revision, I don't have the specifics of it, but it's mostly going to be due to better information both on the revenue and expense side. Because of the October 1 count, we're going to know what the actual enrollment is for the year that we're in right now, and that's also going to impact our revenues. And same thing with salary and benefits. We build, salary and benefit budget for the current year starting back in February and March of last year. So now that the year has actually started, we know what the actual salaries, benefits going to be, needs for capital items, and things like that. So that's going to be part of the budget revision January 24th, of which you two are going to miss out on all the fun and excitement.
Maybe I'll just not tear him up on that one. I'll listen in on that one. How's that?
Yeah. Well, only
I'll bring the smelling salts.
I was just going to say, don't listen to it in a comfortable chair.
Exactly.
Any questions on the budget revision? Okay. Next up, the mill levy correction. Are you familiar with the mill levy correction piece that we... Okay.
Wait a second. Yes?
Yes.
Yes. No. Probably not.
Okay. So, if I can ask the three of you, what have you learned about that? Other than what maybe Douglas and I have talked about in previous meetings.
Pretty much what you guys have talked about.
Okay.
Everything right. I know comes from you, too, on that.
So I'm going to...
I'm probably wrong, but in my mind, it's sharing the benefits of the mill levy with broader districts across the state is my understanding.
I thought the state legislature...
It's a little bit different.
Okay.
So,
which is good you brought that up, because there's different mill levy things being talked about.
Right.
So,
right.
It's not like... because that conversation is going on as well. So this one is a particular one that's law, and why don't you just
They raised it, or you had to be a certain mill levy,
right?
And if you were below it,
right, you had to raise it,
and we were
forcing
below,
you.
Yeah,
yes,
and
yeah.
So that lessens the money they have to pay us because our local taxes mill levy goes up.
Right.
Do I have that right?
Yes. In a nutshell.
Sure.
Perfect. Yes. So I'm going to give you.
I didn't get that far.
So hopefully I don't take you too far into the weeds, and just enough to make you kind of dangerous in terms of trying to understand all of this. But I'm going to do a little Jeopardy type of. I'm going to give you an answer up front, and you're going to know what it's for by the time I'm done with all this. There's two numbers I want to give you.
In 13 years, I've never seen Jeopardy from the CFO. This is cool.
That's awesome.
You guys, you should rethink.
I know. Well.
Okay, so the first number is $8.18, and the second number is $10.22. Okay, I'm going to start way back when.
Do they get to think when they get to try to answer what it is?
They're gonna have a question in the back of their minds as soon as we're done with all this. As soon as I'm done.
Right now, but I can't say what that is.
So, we're all.
This is a public meeting.
Yeah, that's right.
We're all familiar with Tabor, and we know most what. But what most people understand about Tabor is to raise taxes, you have to have an election. Okay? What it also tells you is, as a governmental agency in the state of Colorado, unless you have what's called debruced or detabored, you can only collect so much in revenue from one year to the next based on population increase and inflation. So the combination of those two numbers prevent you from keeping or collecting and retaining revenues above that. Back in November of 1996, the district detabored or debruced, as the vernacular goes, and so that means they could collect and retain as much in revenues as they receive, and not have to refund it back to the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. So because of that, then we could collect all the revenues and keep them. However, CDE over the years had interpreted our ability to maintain our mill levy rate based on their interpretation. And so what they were doing to us, and all districts in the state, is telling us, due to the School Finance Act, that we had to reduce our mill levy rate over the years. And until 2007, when then Governor Ritter said, you know what, the state is telling or is giving is spending as a percentage of the budget too much money for K-12 education. And so I don't exactly know how it mechanically worked at that point in time, but then whatever your rate was, your millage rate was in 2007, it was frozen there and it didn't go down any further thereafter. Ours was frozen at 26.714 mils. Then in 2020, the state legislature got a ruling. I don't remember if it was from the Supreme Court or state attorneys. I don't remember.
It was a very high. It was above CDE.
Right. It was which basically the state said CDE had interpreted this, instructed the districts to lower their rates. They interpreted it wrong, basically, is what they're saying.
It wasn't a proper legal interpretation. It wasn't supported by the law. And I want to add one thing, especially for Rhonda, but to be clear why the mills were dropping. The mills were dropping because assessed valuation was going up.
Right.
And so that's why they were dropping. But they were dropping too much. Or put another way, the districts weren't allowed to retain as much money as they legally could have if they had de-tabored.
Right.
And so Ritter's mill levy freeze stopped that. Well, I guess I shouldn't say it stopped it, and then it was determined later. I don't know whether it was the Supreme Court.
They said it
did go to the state Supreme Court.
I thought it did. I'm not positive, though. I'm not positive.
Go ahead.
One thing I forgot to tell you when I started, I gave you a one-page handout that CDE created. So this piece right here is a handout. I guess you could have been following with me. I guess that was my point in bringing it.
That would have given us all the answer to your question right away.
Okay. All right. So it gives you more background information than I have been giving you. But it's, I thought maybe, you know, you see the words on the paper here, it kind of makes sense, but, and hopefully what I'm doing is kind of helping clear it up and get a better understanding. So fast forward to 2020. State legislature and the IS took actions to correct this interpretation error. This year, the legislature actually passed legislation, HB 21-1164, HB, House Bill 2021, requiring districts to incrementally increase mill rates to 27 mills. What happened last year at this point in time was they said we have to increase the mills, but we don't know the mechanism on how to do it yet, and so the county assessors and treasurers were going to give all school districts a credit for the difference between whatever their mill rate was in 27 mills. And since ours is 26.714, and the second handout I also have underneath this shows you the document that is approved every year by the school board setting our mill rate that we set. This is the worksheet that we send to the state and also the assessor's office, the county assessor's office here, and at the very top right, you'll see where it says the mill levy per HB 20-1418 is 27 mills. The tax credit under that is 0.286. This year, we have to get rid of that 0.286 according to legislation so we can get to 27 mills. And so the question now becomes, what's the cost for a homeowner in the district? So I provided two calculations. One, what's the impact on a $400,000 home in Elbert County, and one on a $500,000 home in Elbert County.
The two numbers.
What's that?
The two numbers.
That's the impact for each one of those.
Per year?
That's just one time. It goes up one time to 27, and so that's going to be the impact this year.
Okay. And it stays there.
So it's that's our impact year over year, unless your house rises in value.
Yeah, if the assessed valuation goes up, well, your rates are, their mills are going to be frozen at 27.
Right.
But then as you, what's that?
The value goes up, so yeah.
Right, so the actual mill stays the same, but the tax burden increases.
And so for Rhonda and new incoming board members, the district doesn't get any more money. That just means the state pays us less.
Right.
Because the state sets our funding. And our property taxes don't pay for all the funding, so the state does the state equalization fund. So when our property taxes go up, the state just pays us less.
They pay less.
We don't get more money.
We get less only if the funding formula
changes.
I'm just saying
this doesn't mean we get any more money. It's the state legislature that sets our funding.
Yes.
And they can raise it or lower.
And it's a common misperception.
It is.
With school districts, that when you pay more taxes, you get your tax bill and you say, wow, it went up. Most people normally logically think we got more money.
Yeah.
And that's not what happens, because it's just what, if we get more, the state
pays less.
Will adjust
less
based on their overall funding.
That's good to know.
It's important to educate
people on, because they don't understand it. Mm-hmm.
That was big when we were running.
Yeah.
When John and I were running, everyone's like, well, you guys get so much money. I'm like, no, we don't.
Our property taxes are going up, so you're getting way more money.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, not. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to throw that in there.
This is provisional, but the analysis that was originally done when they first passed 2014-18, it does increase the amount of revenue that the state gets, and there was the anticipation that school districts would be the beneficiaries of those increased revenues. And one of the questions with a statewide change like that is, you could say, who are the winners and who are the losers? Because we only have to go up this quarter point. It's $8 or $10 a household. There's others that are having to go a full mill, and they have to do that for a number of years. So the maximum yearly is 1 mil until they get to their set. Not everybody has to get to 27. There's a calculation. A lot do, but there's some that because they just have so much assessed valuation, they currently have 4 mils, and they have to get to 8.
Aspen. Think of Aspen.
Aspen, okay. Yeah.
And the odd thing about kind of taxpayer equity is that, you know, a $400,000 home in Elizabeth is going to pay 27 mils on that $400,000 home, or 500 or 600. In Aspen, they're going to only pay 6 mils on it.
There are $400,000 homes in Aspen.
Okay, but there are places.
Storage sheds.
Yeah.
A closet.
Is that equal valued homes around the state can pay huge school taxes because of this. So there are some that are going to be moving up more substantially than us. That's point one. Point two is that the anticipated increased per pupil funding when they did this, I guess a year and a half ago for Elizabeth, was much greater than the increase in taxes collected. So, we paid, this much more in taxes, but the calculations was that we would get this much more back. And when I say this much more, my recollection was it was on the order of a magnitude of $1 million. So it's not insignificant. So, it wasn't a matter of our taxes are increasing a lot and we're not getting an equal share back.
Right.
We were getting a much larger share back than we were kicking in. So we can see once they figure it all out. But back when they started this, that was the expectation. Was that we would likely to be a net beneficiary of this, which is good because we were not a net beneficiary of the School Finance Act forever.
I was going to say it's unusual.
Yeah,
that we're beneficiaries.
And it's one of the reasons that we've struggled financially especially with things like compensation, because we were not receiving an equitable share relative to other communities that were getting, that were the beneficiaries of the formula. Yeah. So, is
yeah.
I'd like to just
that's
make sure that Ron has the opportunity to correct me if I said anything that's
Any questions after that? Hopefully I didn't confuse you anymore. Hopefully it cleared some of this up a little bit and understand it. And so, okay, one last thing that's not completely unrelated, but the governor had to submit his budget by November 1st. He submitted a very, very, very preliminary budget November 1st. In that budget, though, they did break it out, you know, for higher education, PK-12, transportation, and that. And right now, and it's going to have to go through a lot of gyrations to get through the legislature to get to May, but for right now, on average, we're going to get about an extra $500 more per student. And that is the annual increase plus a buy down of the budget stabilization factor. So it's a combination of both. The buy down, as you know, the budget stabilization factor has affected all school districts in the state. So that is very preliminary, but
promising.
Yes, promising. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
That's good.
Give us a little bit of flexibility next year.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for bearing with me.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions?
Ron.
Anything?
What's our count at? What's our count at for the number of students?
I don't know. I don't think it's official yet. Is it?
It's not. Even though it's the October count, it takes at least a month to sort everything out. So sometimes we'll submit for a student, and so will Douglas County. And then they go through this process of whose student is it really, and it will be brought to the board for approval.
Next month, isn't it?
Next month, December.
Yeah, I'm thinking because there's a deadline for submitting it, and I don't know if the 13th of December is. I think it's early enough. The numbers are up, as we've said. They're up beyond what we budgeted. And so that's good. But so you could look at the class size report and kind of do some math.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, there you go.
Count all the classes.
We've learned over the
Thanks,
years.
Thanks, Douglas. You have it in a spreadsheet. You could just do some total. No, I'm kidding.
The weird thing is it doesn't work that way.
I know.
Yeah, because when you grow, you don't get the full, say, $8,000.
Right.
$8,500 per student.
$8,500 per student. You essentially get half of it because of averaging.
Right.
So, you know, when you're decreasing enrollment, you get half. You only see the fiscal impact of half.
Is it a five-year average?
Yes.
Yeah.
Until what point? I can't remember. I know there's something that cuts that
until
off.
The actual per pupil revenue number is greater. The standalone per pupil revenue number is greater than the 5-year average.
That's
number.
What it is. That's
so
what it is.
That's
okay.
When you start getting. That's when you get the full benefit of the increase on a year over year basis. Because right now we're not out of 5-year averaging. We're still benefiting, and I think I talked about this at the last meeting. We're still benefiting better than if we were just getting the funds for what the pure pupil without the 5-year averaging would be.
Right.
So it helps us a lot, and it saved us over the last decade a lot.
Yep.
Budget stabilization factor hasn't helped us, but the 5-year averaging has.
Yeah, for Rhonda, the budget stabilization factor cumulatively over the last, is it now 10 years, has reduced our, it's a pure financial calculation, reduced our budgets collectively by the about $20 million plus $22 million. It's huge. And it's just because of budget cuts from the state and school funding.
It's so, also affectionately known as the BS factor.
That used to be the negative factor, and then they changed it because they didn't like that, so they changed it to the budget stable.
Yeah, it sounded too negative.
And they didn't think about acronyms. It's like, you got to think ahead here, people.
So it was just a mathematical calculation to figure out how much each school district got, and then boom,
cut
it. And then minus this amount.
Yeah.
That's called the budget stabilization factor. Because there are other factors, like the cost of living, you get a little bit. For being rural, you get a little bit. Or for being small, for having at-risk students, you get a little bit. Those are all factors. Mm-hmm. This was, and they're factors to add money, typically, or to calculate how much you get. And the negative factor, or the BS factor, was to take money out. It's kind of like at the end, now we're going to take money out. And so the buy down of the negative or BS factor is getting back to zero, where that money is no longer, where there's no subtraction of funding for school districts. So, are you done with yours? And so it transitions to mine?
Yes. I'll move on to superintendent. Thank you, Ron.
So I'd like to start with the item that's on the agenda, which is the class size report, in a little bit, because you were talking about the
numbers
of students and so forth. And hopefully we got a chance to look at it. Overall, the good news is that our class sizes, from a student perspective, from a teacher perspective, are really good. I mean, the average class sizes, which is not a true, like, actual, because you can see the variations, and that's why we print out every class, so you can see, well, the average is 20 or 22 or the high school, 17. But then you can look and see, okay, what are the actual class sizes? When do we have smaller ones, right? We've got classes, you know, Studio Art 2D with three kids in it. Well, that's probably in the same classroom as Studio Art 1D. Or not 1D, 3D, or that it has one student and then another art class that might have. So they would all be in the same classroom with the same teacher at the same time, but in a different class with a different curriculum. And the one thing that we report in this is when class sizes exceed the recommended ratio, just to highlight it. There isn't a rule about that. And so the notable thing about this report is the middle school. And, you know, I don't think in all our years it's ever been so many classes above the recommended ratio. And so I just wanted to talk a little bit about that. And first to say that the teachers are doing great with it. I mean, it is not, it's not, if you asked any teacher, you know, would you rather have large classes or small classes, with the exception of maybe, you know, concert band or something like that, would you want large class sizes? But they have not been complaining. They have been dealing with it, and they have been accomplishing a lot. So it might look like, oh, this is a huge problem, but for the middle school staff, this hasn't been. Now, that's not to say that it's not something to be paying attention to. They are paying attention to it. But I also, both in terms of like what's happening this year, what does the future look like? And I want to tell you a little bit about kind of what led up to this. So there's kind of two things. One is how they schedule their classes. They use something called the middle school model. The middle school model is around grade level teaming. So there's a sixth grade team, a math teacher, an English teacher. Well, actually, they don't have an English teacher. They have a writing teacher and a reading teacher. And they attribute the splitting of those classes to one of the things, things that contributes to their strong, really strong reading, language arts scores on CMATs. Science teacher, social studies teacher, and then they have electives. And so if sixth grade gets really big, there's just one math teacher and there's just one science teacher for sixth grade, so their classes get bigger. It doesn't allow for flexibility. At the high school level, you can add a math teacher, and they might teach a 9th grade, 10th grade, and a 12th grade math class, right? Or they might teach a whole bunch of 10th grade classes. You have a lot of flexibility. At the elementary level, if you've got, 28 kids in 3rd grade, you can add an additional teacher in 3rd grade, and now you have 15 kids per class, right? But in the middle school, the only way to reduce these class sizes would be to add a math teacher, a science teacher, a reading teacher, a writing teacher, and whatever I missed.
Okay.
So, and if it's at a couple grade levels, I mean, that's a ton of teachers. There isn't an easy mechanism like you have at the other two levels.
Right.
So, there's some good news in all this, and the reason that they're so high is because there was a lot of interest in going to the middle school. So much so that in the summer, the school stopped admitting out-of-district students who wanted to come to Elizabeth Middle School because they saw these numbers and they said, we can no longer accept more students. And so they turned them away, which we haven't really had to do in the past. But we did because we saw the class sizes growing. Now, that's something that's a challenge to do because, like, for example, if you're in a declining enrollment environment, it's kind of like an airline flight. You want to overbook it and hope to fill it and hope not to kick anybody off, right?
Yeah.
Or by their, you know, give them a voucher or whatever.
That's a good analogy.
But we're in a just getting used to growing,
yeah.
And so knowing how to deal with setting that number so that you can accommodate in district students that have a right to go to the school, as long as they enrolled. And I'm getting a little technical here, but as long as they enrolled in the school at the start of the school year and were part of the October camp. Because if a student choice enrolls somewhere else but lives here, and then after October decides they want to come back, they need to finish where they are and they can come back the next year. So there are, and I won't get into some of the technical and what they can do if next year might put every one of these at 35, but we can talk about that. next semester, but there's a couple of strategies to deal with it that aren't at the level of adding 5 teachers per grade level, right? Which is huge, and so there are ways to solve this. But I think that the two really good news is that there was a lot of interest in the school when they had to say no to a lot, and then the other is that the teachers are really dealing with this well. Because as a teacher, when you have, let's say you're a 6th grade science teacher and 6th grade has 180 students, then you're teaching 180 students and you're grading 180 kids. So the more students you have, an elementary school teacher will have a max of 20 to 30 students. That's the range. A high school teacher could have anywhere from 120 to, up, be as high as 150 or 100. I don't know how large actually it'll go, but it can go even beyond 150 students. And that's just, it's a lot of work on a teacher's part to get to know all of those students, their particular learning styles, their challenges, their interests, grading their papers, their tests, and all of that stuff. So that they're dealing with this, I think, is a great accomplishment for the culture and this kind of kid focus. It's like, no, we've got this, we'll deal with it. for Brett, Michael as a new principal, he was kind of, it's like in Douglas County, we've heard this. He was like, oh, because these are better numbers in Douglas County. But that's how we're set up. We're set up to have smaller class sizes. So it is possible, but you don't hear people in Douglas County saying, oh, this is so great. I've got 35 kids per class. You should come teach here because it's a great teaching environment. It's a great learning environment. There's trade-offs for that for most subjects in most classes. So, you know, the fact that our teachers are willing to be on this high end and do the work, I think, is a lot of kudos.
So, just one question.
Yeah.
You said there's a lot of interest in the middle school. Was that the same across the district, or is it just for some reason the middle school?
No, I don't think that it was just the middle school.
Okay.
It was just that the middle school's schedule isn't as flexible
as
the
right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Good.
So we'll see when we get the October count, and I don't know that we'll be able to analyze the October count when we get it to you at the same time, so we'll probably just present it to you, because it takes a while to then really, in a credible way, to go and make comparisons over time. And we won't even begin that process until we have it, and we probably won't have the actual numbers till the beginning of December. So
that's why I asked the question now.
Test you.
Any other questions?
That's good.
Okay. Shifting gears, it's a little bit like maybe elementary school, there's no show and tell. But
nothing. We're good.
Are you making fun of me?
I can hear on both sides here.
Okay, so I said a little show and tell. I mentioned this in our last meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see if I can make this a little bit bigger. So this is the teacher salary work that I've been working on with a lot of involvement from the board, because this started with presentations at CASB with board members.
Yep.
It's presented to the state legislature, the State Board of Education, to superintendent groups. CASE, it's been presented, I think, more than a dozen times
Over the last 8 years, you and Elizabeth School Board have actually been the presenters at CASB for other school boards on this stuff.
So, just when COVID hit, I didn't update it, but there were just a number of requests for it and a growing need, in part because the legislature was looking at school finance, looking at how to make changes. And in addition to that, I'm on a task force, was appointed to it, that's the Educator Pay Raise Fund Task Force. So the legislature created passed legislation to create an educator pay raise fund, and part of that legislation created a task force of 12 people, and kind of from a variety of backgrounds. Some of them are from school districts. There's two rural school superintendents. And the legislation even includes a statement about rural schools and trying to deal with low salaries in rural schools. So that task force meets for the second time tomorrow night, and I'm going to present this to them tomorrow night. And then on Wednesday morning, I'm presenting this to the Rural Alliance Advocacy Zoom call that has anywhere from 120 to 140 people on it. That includes state level, school board members, superintendents. It's been meeting every week since COVID started, with the exception of Christmas and I think Thanksgiving. But it's been the most reliable and well-attended group through the pandemic. So I wanted to I didn't want to do the full presentation, but I just wanted to give you a taste of it. And can you read can you read this okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple of impacts that this has had that I would say, are both encouraging and have been frustrating. So as you look at these numbers, you kind of go, oh, wow, that's striking. There are patterns to what districts are able to do that people in a district don't realize they're part of a pattern. They're part of a biased funding system that isn't fair. Because it's not that individual districts are choosing to pay teachers low salaries because they are using the money for other things. It's because the formulas and the mechanisms don't give districts enough money to pay their teachers well. And that's what's been very eye-opening. What, Carol, and you can remember this because you were there from the beginning, that when this has been presented to CASB, for example, for a resolution, there were districts like, large districts, I won't mention names, that were like, oh no, this is a race to the bottom if we try to fix this. And there was a fair amount of resistance to solutions. But what more important than their resistance, what we realized is that people didn't understand what was going on. It was kind of like they had a kind of quick aha moment, like this is a problem. And then they wanted to race to solve it without understanding it. And then they'd say, well, let's do this. No, but you can't do that because look at the numbers. And then they go, oh, well, then let's do this. And no, that doesn't work either because look at these numbers. And they just didn't understand. So we said, we're just not going to get in the business of recommending solutions, and we're going to just focus on helping people understand what's going on in the state without, authority on, well, and this is the fix, other than there needs to be a collective will to fix it that's going to be driven by an understanding of the fact that there's an issue. So this is a database of 178 school districts. It doesn't include the Charter School Institute, and it doesn't include BOCES that also both of them employ teachers. And it's sorted based on the 2021 average salary. Average salary. So the average salary is calculated by CDE, but it takes into account the years of experience and the education level of teachers in every district. So it's not a reflection purely of a salary schedule. Is this a good salary schedule or a bad salary schedule? But it is a reflection of how much you can pay teachers. How well can you attract experienced teachers, teachers that have more education, in addition to how good is your salary schedule? But I'll show you here in a sec. When you compare the average teacher salary to the cost of living, that becomes really interesting to see which districts can pay a wage close to or not or above the cost of living. So this is the column that this is sorted on, and this is the rank in reverse. So this is the 178th lowest average salary, $28,000 average salary in Vilas.
Just a note on that one, on that first one. Total teacher FTE 2009 to 10, 27.8. And then you go there, 2021, it's 8.8.
Yeah, this district, I think this may be on online.
Oh,
they might have an online program.
Yeah, okay.
Right? But not Mountain Valley. Yeah. Right? So it looked like they had decreasing.
Yeah.
Why the heck would you stick around?
Right, exactly, for that.
Right.
And the turnover, 44.45%?
So the value for users of this is not a PDF. This is a sortable database. So you can take this data and you can add a column, multiply two things together, and come up with your insight into this data. You can sort it however you want. And so it becomes a usable tool for people to ask and answer questions based on what they're seeing. So you could look at the change in staff between this year and this year, create a new column here and say, did your staff go up? Did you go down? Because that's an interesting number for you, right? And there are some districts that are growing and they're adding teachers. Is there a correlation between growing a growing district? Because you can also, there's students. So you're adding students, you're adding teachers. Are you able to pay better if you're in that situation? Is it harder to pay if you're in this declining situation? So I'm just going to scroll down And I want you, the colors there, this whatever, tan, light tan, they're rurals. There's two categories of rural: small, and then above 1,000 is just rural. And I think the largest might be, we can see when we get the bottom, it might be rowing 4 or something like that. I think that the largest you can be to be classified as rural is 6,500. But it's defined by CDE using both state and federal kind of parameters for how close are you to a metro area, et cetera, et cetera. So, let's see if I can... it doesn't work with me. Your Band-Aids.
Oh.
So I can get this to work. There we go. Let's see if I can get it to scroll down. There we go. You can, and I'll go slow enough so that you can kind of look at both some of the names of the districts and some of their salaries. Sorry, it moves around like that.
You can just use your down arrow, Douglas. Or not.
Or not. Sorry.
Forgot it's an apple.
I've got, I crushed my fingers in the window and I've got Band-Aids and it doesn't have what I was going to ask.
Oh.
So one of the things you're looking for is Elizabeth. Has anybody seen it yet? Coming up here.
Yeah.
Okay. If you look to the left, we're at like 91, well, minus 3, 80, 88 or something like that. These are all... the lowest average. They're all rural. I'm sorry about that.
And so we're classified as rural.
We're not small rural because we're not less than 1,000.
Okay.
The first non-rural district that comes up at number 101 of the number of districts, I'm looking all the way to the left, is Falcon 49. Still. And then Harrison. Now the blue are Colorado Springs area districts. Whitefield. And then the gray don't fit into an easy category. There's about 6 that are other. It's not rural, but it's not near a metro area, and it's not a resort. So you see it's predominantly rural with a few Colorado Springs districts. We're now at average salaries, Academy 20, $51,000, right? Right there at the bottom, School District 27J, that's bright. That is the first Denver Metro District that we've seen on this list. They're all green, okay, at 52.
And they're over the cost of living. Well, no,
yeah. I'll do that next, because that's another, there's so much data here.
Yeah, I'm trying to reach.
Starting to get closer to the cost of living.
But that's what makes it so useful.
These for 2017.
Mm-hmm. There we go. So East Grand. There's 6 resort, and I define them in this somewhat arbitrary, but as ski resort. Mm-hmm. They're resort, but that's because they have a ski resort in their community. And so even though it's rural, it's much higher, and you'll see a pattern there. Now, we're almost to the end. Oops, I don't know what that line is there. So that's the end. You see that it's all green now. The highest average salaries are all a combination of Denver Metro and Resort. And the highest one there that barely even comes close is Colorado Springs 11. But this district here, Englewood, you know what, I can't, I'm going to do it like this. I'm going to use the pointer. Englewood has an average salary of $58,000, which, I don't know what happened to my sorting here. This line should be there. anyway, that is the average teacher salary in the state. So all of these districts have above average teacher salary. There's, and the only rurals are
resorts.
And there isn't a single Colorado Springs in that mix. So there's something about geography that's behind this.
Lobbyists.
When you look at, pardon me?
Lobbyists.
Well, right.
They can afford them.
Oops, let's see if I can get this thing. I apologize that I'm not easier with this. So, Carrie, you were looking at, so what I'm going to do.
Cost of living.
Is it going? Would you rather have, I'm going to go over here. The percent, the average salary is below or above the cost of living,
yeah.
Or the amount? What do you care more about, the amount or the percent?
The amount is kind of a little clearer indication.
Probably more impactful when you see the actual dollar amount.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Oh, man. It's so hard. There, that's, is that column, right? Oh, shoot. Let's see. It should work, right?
It should.
We were trying to figure
spend
out how to make
time
this
on
easy.
It. We should.
So we want, it's going to be ascending. So we just resorted it, and it took us back up. So we're looking at just this column right here.
Okay.
This is the amount. The average teacher salary is in Vilas, in Liberty, below their cost of living. Because one of the incorrect assumptions is rural schools can have lower salaries because it's less cost of living. The cost of living data that's in this is produced by a company hired by the Legislative Council of the legislature. So it's the Legislative Council are the lawyers to the legislature. And every 2 years, that report is produced, and it feeds into the funding formula, because one of the factors in the formula is cost of living. So it's a consistently applied methodology to determine the cost of living that does have implications for how everybody is and has been funded for years. So let's see if I can go down on that list.
You need a mouse.
I need a mouse. I do. I have a mouse.
Yeah, it'd be easier to use a mouse.
And I usually use a mouse. There we go.
Look at it.
So
their cost of living is, like right here, you're looking at 15, 16 grand lower.
The average salary.
Right.
The
salary is
lower
than the
average
cost of living.
Yeah. Okay, that's not the starting salary. That's the average.
Yeah, that's
average. Yeah, that's true.
The gap.
Starting salary, we're even much lower.
And again,
Elizabeth. Okay, so we are starting salary.
Our average.
Average. $10,688 below cost of living.
Below.
Which is probably $20,000 per starting.
So our cost of living is slightly less than Douglas County. $1,500 is slightly less. But the difference between our average salary and cost of living is 10, and theirs is almost nothing.
Yeah.
Let's see if this works. Is it working? Is this working?
Is it on?
I don't see it. Do you guys see it? Thank you, Paul. So, with this, the first non-rural district is like 77 or something with Aspen, because they have such a incredibly high cost of living, mostly driven by housing costs.
Right.
Rural cost of living, the thing that people don't realize is health care is incredibly high. When you see a map of the relative health care costs right? I showed you that before. So let's just keep going down, right? You kind of see this pattern that we saw before, right? You have these Colorado Springs districts. You begin to see a couple of resorts, because they're showing up higher on this list because their difference between cost of is not, they have the really high salaries, but they also have high cost of living.
Yes.
And you can see now you begin to have... So Douglas County...
What number were we, was Elizabeth, sorted this way? I'm just curious.
Yeah, let me go back.
Yeah, okay.
Let me go to the bottom,
okay.
And then I'll go back up.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I can. Yeah. That's the thing. It's anybody can look at this. So interesting, right? Well, they have the highest average salaries, but look at this. There is zero right there. So they're all above. They not only have the highest average, but they're all above their cost of living.
Look at Boulder, holy cow!
Okay, so there is something happening in the way that funding. It's my guess is a combination of the formula, assessed valuation, mill levies, mill levy overrides, and the capacity of districts to pass generous mill levy overrides, mm-hmm. right? Which way out on the other side of the spreadsheet are how much commercial property does a district have.
Yep.
Elizabeth has the second lowest percentage of commercial property of every district in the state, and commercial property pays a lot when you pass in a levy overlay. So, oh, look, my numbers are working.
Woo!
I'm feeling back in control. Do you see it? I don't know. Do we? I think it was up higher.
I think it was up higher.
Yeah, it was.
Because it was 10. So.
Yeah.
We're at 10, yeah. It's right in there. There it is.
There it is. Okay, so 69.
You got
and
minus
our other
three.
Ranking was 88.
67.
Or 67?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's three rows at the top.
Gotcha.
Because
Yeah.
Okay. We can do one more on this theme here, which is, do you want to do base salary amount or base salary percent?
Amount.
Amount. Now, this is, you know, Aspen was at the top of the list of average salaries, but they're bottom of the list in terms of starting salaries relative to cost of living. Interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that's important as you begin to look at policy is to say, we can't design around Aspen. Aspen needs to be like, you know, you can't not do something because, oh, it does X, Y, or Z to Aspen, because they're clearly a unique district. They're
right.
Not the norm. Because, again, look at the norm. Fingers, they stuck. There we go. Okay, so it's the amount. So you can see these amounts. These are starting salaries for teachers. 20 below their cost of living.
And we're 19,304.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There, now my finger's working. But you see the same pattern, looking at the colors. It's all rural. So whether you sort of starting salaries, average salaries, against cost of living, or just the average salaries, it's all rurals.
Yeah.
That are all worked off. And it's that pattern that we found shocked people. And it's why, in part, it's in the legislation. They call out rules.
Yeah.
So, let me see if I can. Sorry for that. Littleton has a very high average salary, but they start low and they have big steps and big lanes. So their average is much higher, and they attract experienced teachers, but their starting salary is lower than other
metro area cost of living,
relative to the cost of living.
Yeah.
And then, this is really unexpected. I'm just kind of trying to go. These are no info. So Kristen has been, this was difficult starting because we had to go on every district's website and get their salary schedule, and then those that didn't have it on their website, and it's required to have it on it by law. And these are the ones that we just couldn't get. It's required by law. They weren't on there. We contacted them, we meaning Kristen. They've been coming in, and we've been entering that because everything else comes from publicly available databases on the CDE website, on the state legislature's website, on the Colorado State Finance website. So really, I guess I should kind of stop this chart kind of here, and you can see that the amounts of starting below the cost of living are, in these districts right here, just a couple thousand, but it gets
still,
you know, these
most
are not,
of them are metro.
Right, again.
You have a big jump.
And you have to. You can see over here the things, and I just haven't had the opportunity to, I just haven't had the time really. This is the amount raised by 1 mil. Look at these differences. 1 mil in Poudre raises that much money.
Hey, Douglas, can I ask you a question you might get posed with, or maybe you have been posed with, and I haven't heard the question asked here, I don't think. Is that cost of living per household or per individual?
It has a definition. It's for, I think it's a family of three.
Okay, got it.
In the bottom there's a link.
Okay.
To the report, and the report defines all of its aspects.
Got it. I was just curious about. So this is if that specific teacher in that district was the sole provider for the household of three people, this is the disparity. Got it.
Right, and the thing that's useful about it is that it's just whether that's the right definition
sure.
using it's consistently applied.
Yes, it is. Yes.
So what you can see is the differences relative to that number versus that, I mean, I think that through experience we can hear and know that there's an issue between cost
sure.
of living and salaries.
For sure.
To not get overly caught up in the exact number,
yeah.
but to understand order of magnitude and differences in a public education system that's supposed to provide opportunities for all kids independent of where you live.
Right.
And I did the color coding because there is a geographical dynamic that is happening that is somewhat complicated. I mean, you'd say this isn't just one thing that's driving this. And then how you fix it is not an easy answer, which is why they haven't fixed it before. But so over here, you know, you can see the different amounts raised by 1 mil. So who's that? That's Denver. But then you can see the amount raised per student. Okay, so even though they can raise a lot of money, so they can do big bond projects, you know, 1 mil, they can do a 13 million or 2 million. They don't have to have very many mils, and they can generate a lot of money. But the per student amount isn't that high. Prairie can generate a ton of money per student for a mil. And so this is one of the things that's very different. Ooh, that's interesting.
Ooh, I can't read that.
you need to go to the eye doctor.
So if you just look at that column where it is over there, look at Pawnee is really high. There's just really odd differences around the state. So if you're interested in mills and mills rate, total mills raised mill per student.
We're 72. Elizabeth.
Right, we're kind of low.
Yeah.
Not kind of, we are low.
Right, and so a lot of, now there's another piece to this that's amount raised by district voter approved overrides. Well, you can see there's a bunch of districts that have zero. Now, they're not always the low numbers, but they often are the ones that have low amounts. Now, this hasn't been, this as of this date, we did pass for it. This is not bonds. There's 35 districts that have no mill levy overrides, and most all of them are rural. Because it's difficult to raise the money. They don't have the tax base. They don't get much for their money. So East Grand is Winter Park, Granby, and another community. Grand Lake, Fraser, that area. It doesn't include, there's a West Grand, which is, I forget the name of that town. But anyway, they just passed a bond, and I asked Ron, I said, how much do you think there? They have 1,100 students, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
So they just passed a bond, a nice big bond. How much do you think the bond is for? You know, how much could a district of 1,100 kids, you know, and they have a bunch of needs? Just guesses. What?
100,000.
100,000?
100,000?
It's a bond. For buildings and stuff.
Right. Say 2 million.
So get into the millions.
I'd say two million.
2 million? What could they pass? Do you want just
5 million.
What?
5 million.
5 million.
I'll go back to 8 million.
85 million.
What?
What?
Holy cow.
Really?
They passed a bond. They have approximately 1,100 students. They passed an $85 million bond.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh. I mean.
That would never happen. Holy cow.
Right, and there are 1,100 kids. We're twice as many kids.
Yeah.
So there's the ability.
What are they going to do with that?
Yeah. Build 10 schools?
Build another ski resort?
School. Yeah, school for child.
They're going to add CTE programs. They're going to do all kinds of stuff. So, here's a... you can add, if you care about what percentage of the budget goes to teacher salaries, that's not publicly available. But like the task force was interested in that. Somebody from CDE is on the task force, so... They've got the data.
Right.
It's a matter of extracting it or figuring it would be a simple calculation with data columns that they have. And that can be added in here. And then you can sort all of this by, and it could be a minimum requirement for qualifying for a grant to increase teacher salaries to say, right. Well, you have to be spending at least such and such. But one of the things Ron and I know is rural districts tend to spend less a lower percentage of the overall budget on teacher salaries because of the dynamics of scale that like, for example, capital items and other dynamics that, as a whole, rural districts tend to spend less than metro districts as a percent of their overall budget on teacher salary, which is like we're spending less and we have the lower salaries. So that's because our economics are different, and it's not because districts are choosing to devalue teachers, right? Because this also has turnover, and you can see correlations with this in turnover. So anyway, this is designed to help people understand some of the patterns and give them some ability to also do their own analysis, and we'll see where it goes.
People on the task force take, what their take is on the presentation.
See, our rank is second in terms of residential assessed value commercial.
Wow.
What is this assessed value percent? Some of these, it's hard to just, I guess it's residential, so that would be the one to go off of here. The number looks low, though.
76.8.
I guess that's the second highest percent in the state. And it's very low. It's not the lowest commercial, because some of these have, like, for example, agriculture, or they'll have oil and gas will be really high. Right? And so those are some of the dynamics that happen. Commercial, ag, oil and gas that make the kind of taxing capacity. So I don't mean to get into the weeds with that other than to illustrate why this is a challenge. And it's not easy to figure out how you have a formula, how you support overrides, So one of the things that legislatures have been looking at and committees are looking at is there a way to supplement mills in districts that have a really hard time raising them? Because people tend to think that because the community doesn't support them, that it's because the community doesn't support their education system. It's because it's not a good deal. Here you pay $10 and you get, you know, whatever, a wood shop machine. In Cherry Creek, you pay $10 and you get an innovation center. Mm-hmm. And those differences, the value proposition can be very different. And so it's just not right to assume that just because Rocky Ford can't pass something, that's because they have a bad system and people don't support education. Like, well, you know, you're only getting 10 cents on the dollar what they get in Douglas County.
Right.
And so they're saying, I don't get much for this. I have to pay a lot, I don't get much. So, anyway, thank you for your patience with
that.
With your Band-Aids. With your Band-Aids.
And my Band-Aids, yeah. I've been using my mouse in my office, and so I didn't realize I would have that problem. I have a couple of other things. One is just an update on COVID. Unfortunately, it's in the news. It's still an issue. I want to give you an update on a number of different things. I think I'll start. I had it here in my notes kind of at the end, but I'll start by saying what we're doing is working. It's working really well. And in August and early September, we did not know whether it was going to work. We had to try it. We had to see. And then as time passed, and now that we're in whatever we are, middle of November, it is working. And I'll hint at a couple of reasons why I say that when I give kind of the components. But thank you for your support, for your guidance, for your feedback. Because I think that part of the reason that it's worked and is working is because of your engagement on the issue and how you've guided us through. So we have given out, I don't know exactly how many are sitting in the offices, but at least 1,000 rapid tests. If you think of each of those tests helped somebody figure out what was going on for themselves and for their families. And rapid tests have been hard to find. So they're provided to us by the state for free. We give them out for free. And we have more right now than we've had for two reasons. One, the number of cases has dropped, even though the state has had more, Elbert County and us as a school district, we just haven't had that many.
Yeah.
And so that's been very helpful for people to have quick information and to decide what to do. We exclude folks, staff, and students that are ill. It's like that's across the board. But it's different if they have COVID or just a sinus infection. And what they do and what we do based on the results of the test, we don't require anybody to take a test, but many people take it. They don't need to report it. It's not part of a state reporting system. But if they're positive, we do tell the county. We are obligated by law to tell the county health, and we do tell them. But we just give them the basic information of their name, the school that they go to, the grade level, and the date that they were positive or began the symptoms. That's what we tell them. So we could not be doing what we're doing without those rapid tests, because it gives us information that we need to have to be making decisions and to know what's happening in our schools.
Right.
And it's been able to allow us to know that there has been very little spread in the buildings, which is what everybody's concerned about, is spread in different environments. And, you know, there is a perception that it spreads a lot in schools because there's all these outbreaks or whatever, but that's not the case. And we're not alone in that regard. There's been relatively little spread in schools, even though they declare outbreaks, but their method for declaring outbreaks has been a little bit generous, meaning to say, instead of just 5 in a classroom, if there's 5 in the school or more, they'll say there's an outbreak. But all of those could have come from the outside. The really important measure that we've looked at is, you know, are people getting it at school? We continue to purchase HEPA air filters. They have worked. They're proven to work. I just this weekend read a NASA study very technical, but the bottom line was HEPA filters, they work at filtering out these particles. So we had a grant of $106,000. That includes the charter school, and we are continuing to buy HEPA filters so that we'll have two large units. These units, they need really about four in a classroom based on what they cover to 80-90% cover the room. We started out with one, but we will get to two large units. The larger units are twice this size in every classroom, plus some small ones, offices, conference rooms, all that kind of stuff. So I don't know the exact date, but we're buying as many as we can. They'll be covered by the grant. The grant goes back to being purchased as of April 1st. We'll have surplus money from the units to be able to buy a lot of the replacement filters. So we'll be able to have replacement filters, because that will be an ongoing cost right. in the future. As I mentioned, our case numbers have been relatively low these past couple of weeks, even though Colorado is going up. Elbert County has been doing well on both cases, but if you say, well, people aren't reporting cases, we are. The number of hospitalizations and deaths was two other measures that, you know, they're recording. You can't kind of avoid that reporting. They've also been historically lower than the state average in Elbert County. So that's good news. With regards to mandates, especially vaccine mandates for students or staff, or mask mandates, we're continually watching what's going on both nationally and in the state. And we will not do a vaccine mandate or a mask mandate. And we are prepared to take that stand. And we're not doing it just to reject it, because what we are doing is keeping people safe. We don't need vaccine mandates to keep everybody safe at school. We don't need mask mandates because we don't have masks and we're keeping people safe. So we're building both the community relations material to be able, if we have to further make that case, as well as just initially we've alerted our lawyers of what we would need to do legally. And those two things, of course, need to be coherent.
Yes.
But that's our... You know, that's our approach, is if there is a mandate that is issued, to be able to not force that on our staff or students, and to be able to defend it with evidence, science, and a history of keeping folks safe. The federal vaccine mandate for employers of 100 or more, you may have read in the news that it applies to schools. It doesn't apply to schools in Colorado, and it doesn't apply to schools in a number of states because they have an OSHA plan, and states with an OSHA plan aren't part of that. So that at the federal level. But the governor still has the ability to mandate masks and vaccines. And you probably have seen it, you know, Denver and a whole bunch of counties around Denver for large venue events.
Yes.
So that's my goal.
We went to the Bronco game yesterday, and we were prepared. Mm-hmm. You know, we brought our masks, because they were saying in the breezeways down where the vendors are and the restrooms that you should wear them, and you didn't have to wear them outside. And I saw five out of thousands of people that had a mask on. You know, it was just, and they had notices at that when you're walking up, you know, please wear your mask when you're in an enclosed area.
The issue for more risky environments is indoors with bad air circulation. So that's why we have window door, and we have the filters and we have the fans, and that's working, and it's proven. And it shows up in the UK press. It shows up in other international press. It's all the information not only is out there, it's been out there since last summer.
Yes.
So I'm still finding things that were written last summer, even as early as May, that basically the science of aerosol spread, not on the surfaces. And then the mitigation strategies, which include masks, but that's been all the public policy focus, is all on masks. There's been no public policy in the United States on ventilation and air quality. There has been much more significant in other countries. England has been doing public service announcements since last November on, in the winter, open your windows a little crack.
Yeah.
Or you can open them a lot for 15 minutes or just keep them cracked. And there's a significant decrease of the concentration of the virus if you do that in your car. If you're, you know, whatever, a little crack. So we've been doing this now for a year and a half. And so we have the results, both in terms of, you know, information about cases, the CO2 monitoring. We're monitoring right there. I can tell you here at before you leave what it is, it takes me a second to look at it. So we have that data as well. So not only have we made the improvements, and I point to Ron because he and his staff, you know, a year and a half ago, made a lot of improvements to our ventilation systems to be able to do this, but we're not just saying, well, we increase the outdoor air, we're running the things, we've got the filters, we're following all the advice, but we're able to validate that it's working or when it's not working, because every once in a while, like when the electricity went out at Singing Hills a week ago, it went out for a short amount of time. I don't know, it was short. Anyway, I don't know how it went out. All the CO2 monitor, they all spiked because the HVAC stopped. It's like, okay, this is working. So that's why I started by saying it's working. It's not just an anti-mask, anti-this or that approach that we're taking. It's very much investing in proactive with another absolutely proven mitigation strategy that hasn't been dominant in public policy in the state or really nationally. And it's not like we're the only district that's taking this seriously, but we absolutely, if we're not the leader, one of the leaders in the state in what we are doing instead of mandates.
Agreed.
Other questions or...
That's awesome.
It is.
No, but I mean, think about it. We're the leaders of it. And then I mean, why are other districts not calling us to say, like, what are you doing? Or are they? Or
no, not really. I mean, when this Colorado Public Radio article came out and had, you know, highlighted us and stuff, not a single call.
Wow.
The only time we got a call when there was a press about a dispute with
public health.
And we got bombarded for that. Bombarded 5 news agencies.
But nothing else.
No. So there's just people have kind of committed to different strategies.
So the negativity. That's what's a shame.
And anyway, you know, we didn't know when we did this, because it was without masks, we didn't know what it would, you know, how safe we could get people when we started schools, and we didn't know that we'd have so many cases so quickly. I mean, so there was, and that's why I say thanks for your support of, you know, taking that risk. It was a calculated risk. We thought it was a small risk, but we didn't know. And it's proven to work. You know, the whole thing. It's not like just one thing. Lori has been central. And the trust that she's developed with staff and everybody's cooperation, the parents' cooperation. I mean, it's been great. They've told us, you know, it's like, okay, this is what happened. And then we can go from there. And without that, we would be nowhere. We have not signed up for the state, like, screening testing. They've been pressuring us.
Right.
But it's like, this is working. We don't need that. It's not helpful. It's not timely. This is totally timely. You're sick right now. Take it. And let us know, and then adapt. So let's see. I know this has been a long report.
I'm being generous with you for the last time. That's my
gift to you. You're generous.
See where you're supposed to be? You're very generous.
I'm making the next president look good, too. If I let the meeting go.
Yeah.
You're gonna
wait a minute. You know, now, but you're making me look bad because
I'm going to make whoever it is look good because
that's right.
We're an hour late already.
Yeah.
I'm so worried.
No pressure.
But that's my parting gift to you. Go as long as you want. Thank you very much. I don't want to be here till 11.
But nobody's totally falling asleep, at least they're on the table. I'm not focusing
they
on
might
that.
Be.
I did see Martin go over there once and look at his watch. But he's also free to leave.
It's the chair. I tied a comfier chair and it's like.
She's falling back.
Well, thanks for letting me do this, because this took a bunch
that's
of time.
No, that's
you
good.
Guys seemed interested in it.
Yes,
but it's
very.
Helping me to understand the time that it takes to go through it for the task force tomorrow, because I could take up, I don't know how long it was, half hour or more. I mean, they're not going to, I'm not going to have that much time on the task force. Yeah, anyway. Another thing that I wanted to present to you and just see whether there's board support or kind of consensus, thumbs up kind of thing, is related to Frontier and the proceeds from the Frontier sale. You're new to the board, but this board, whether you started 9 years ago or whether you started 2 years ago, has spent a significant amount of time addressing both the operational costs of Frontier, leading to closing Frontier, because it was costing more than twice as much as every other student to have a student be in Frontier. The building costs there were part of it, but not by any means the only reason. And then also deciding to sell the building. And part of the reason, you know, because we could have just closed Frontier, but you also supported a recommendation to sell the property. But I also believe you did that with an understanding of generally where the money would go. So I wanted to just follow up and clarify our recommendation for the parameters of where those proceeds would go. I don't like the idea of spending money before you actually have it. It's expected, the property is expected to close, I think, on the 15th or thereabouts of December. Given that this board has been through a lot, including the public feedback, et cetera, to see your level of support for the more specific guidance around how the proceeds would be used. So the recommendation would be to allocate the net proceeds, because you have to subtract, right, the net proceeds to capital investments at all four schools in areas that have clear and positive student impact. So not to improving the cement in front of the gym at the high school,
right,
which I would love to, right? That would be done through the capital budget. That we believe, and you do as well, that it's important for the community to be able to see the positive impact on and relevance for students.
Right. Yeah.
So that it doesn't just go into the general fund reserves, it doesn't go into like the long multi-million-dollar capital improvement list, but it has a direct impact on the kids at every school. So the areas that we have narrowed down would be, for example, improvements to the playgrounds at both elementary schools. So like the addition of a lower field at Running Creek, which has been something they've been dreaming about, putting plans together for, I know, more than 12 years. Mm-hmm. Singing Hills also needs improvements in their play space. So the same kind of level of investment and same target. When you ask elementary kids what they like best about school,
recess.
Right? And you know, recess is being outdoors, getting that. It's important. It's important through the winter, and it's important with COVID. And frankly, we could do better. Especially Running Creek, because they need a bigger place to run around.
Right.
Yeah.
And then investing in long-lasting infrastructure and equipment to support one or more career-connected, hands-on, skill-building programs at the middle and high school. Programs like woodshop or something similar at the middle school, and auto mechanics at the high school or something similar. Or and we don't know the full cost, because we haven't really had the resources to be able to sit, to even
think about it,
right? So using a rough estimate of the possible net proceeds, the recommended distribution would be approximately $125,000 for each of the elementary schools, $175,000 for the middle school, and $300,000 for the high school. And then they could be adjusted depending on the actual net proceeds, but in kind of in those proportions. And then once the plans were fully developed, it would come back to the board for final approval within these parameters. Or if for some valid reason they said, you know, there's another idea that was within these general guidelines, but instead of wood shop, it was motocross and small engines, or a greenhouse for agriculture, or construction program. So, thoughts, reactions, support, questions?
You got my thoughts.
I like it.
I read that. I think that hits it. It's got to be for the benefit of the students.
Yeah, I agree.
So, something they can actually appreciate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Visible. So they can see where it went versus poof.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. We want it to be like you don't have to explain it.
Yeah.
You can kind of see it, and you can see that it's beneficial to kids.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we thought that would be the easiest way, you know, and that it has a direct impact on kids, that wasn't like, where'd that money go?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Yeah. And we think that at all levels there could be opportunities for partnerships. So, like auto mechanics, maybe there's a partnership with Big O. Maybe for the field, there's a partnership with Parks and Rec, or the town, or getting a GOCO grant. So, it could be that they're able to do more through grants, donations, partnerships, whatever, on any of these things. But that this would be enough to say, look, there's a lot that we can do, and here's our starting. And if we're dreaming bigger, and we can get the partnerships, then great.
Yeah.
Okay, I like it.
Nice. And then the last thing is, I wanted to just comment on the new action item, which is a change to the school calendar. The board approves that calendar. I have the authority to make changes to that calendar for safety. So that's snow closures and other things, but typically it's snow closures. But I don't have the authority to make other changes. That rests with you, though. And our teacher advisory committee made a recommendation to end the semester and start Christmas break a day earlier. So the last day of school is, I believe, December 17th before Christmas break. And it's a half day. And it's not a strong instructional day, except at the high school, where they typically have, it's their last day of 4 days of finals. And that if families, both staff and families in 10 schools, could start their break a day earlier, we think for the vast majority of people that would be beneficial. And that our students have worked really hard this year, and so have our staff, and we really think it would be a great kind of gift to give them that would not cost the district anything financially, that it would be a paid non-work day, and that it would not have an impact on instruction and academics by doing it then. So it could be that there's no financial cost, but there is a kind of a learning loss or whatever, and we don't feel like there would be.
Because it's only half a day.
Well, right. The vast majority of parents that I know pull their kids that
exactly.
day anyway.
Yeah. Right.
So.
And then high school finals would be moved to Monday through Thursday.
Yes.
With their new schedule, the Monday is only 4 of the 8 classes, so the other 4 classes don't get a day, which a teacher high school teacher who's been on the calendar committee for many years said, we would just use that Monday for a review.
Right.
Yeah.
But the other classes wouldn't get a review, so it kind of makes it a little fairer in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't see an issue with that. And then we would have to look and see whether we would offer Kids Club that day or not. And if there were staff that had to work that day, that we would give them a kind of trade for another day if they to be able to take off.
Right.
And we think they would do great things for morale, according to our staff and the principals and the teacher advisor committee. And
I agree.
Great. So later then, I just am telling you
that,
so that when you,
yes,
you get the action item,
that's just
kind of laying out the reason for it.
Okay.
Great.
And I don't, we don't have the calendar here, so if the motion would be to just to have December 17th be a non-school day.
Okay. Yep.
And non-work day. Is that?
Yep.
Because we don't have a different calendar. But one of the feedback that we received was this is all doable with advance notice. So this isn't something to do at the next board meeting in December 15th.
Right.
Or whenever it's December 13th.
Yeah.
To get that number wrong.
What about extracurricular activities? Theater, right, band, sports? Is that kind of left up to the individual teams?
Yeah, that would all be.
Okay.
So, you know, like, there could be a number of things. Like, we could have a food delivery on that Friday. Well, the staff would need to be here.
Got
for
it.
That.
Okay.
You know, if they had a practice that day,
yep,
then they should still practice.
Got it.
But we would want to make sure that the coach,
okay,
or the kitchen staff or the food service staff get the same benefits. So
absolutely.
It's kind of a fair across the board.
Absolutely. That's what I was wondering. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions?
No.
I think
we're probably band is going forward then too, right? Like for the future.
It's something the calendar committee could look at, because they will look at all these kind of ideas. They would like to look at having a longer fall break, and so they'll look at that, which might be the Thursday parent teacher conferences and no work on Thursday. We do all the parent-teacher conferences by Wednesday,
mm-hmm,
but that'll go through the calendar committee, and you guys won't have to. So anyway, those kinds of permanent calendar changes will be considered as a package,
yeah,
where you have to look at the minimum number of hours, the minimum number of days. We typically don't have issues with the minimum number of days because we have 170, and you only need 160. It's hours where we have a minimum number of hours that we need to meet, and we have five,
yeah,
days plus some hours built in for snow. So
yep,
that needs to be a more comprehensive,
sure,
discussion.
Yep.
All right.
Is that it?
That's it.
Don't ask that question.
Sure.
Thank you.
No, I said, don't ask that question.
Yeah.
Is that it? Because she
oh,
leaves,
right,
that,
yes,
door open.
She never learned that.
I never did learn that. Okay. There isn't anybody here. Well, there are people here for public comment, but there's no public comment. So we'll move on.
That was a fast 10 minutes.
Just shave 10 minutes, right?
Make it up time.
We need to do this consistently.
Well, daylight savings time, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, we are still adjusting.
Yeah.
Consent agenda. Can I get a motion to approve items 9.1 through 9.6?
So moved.
Second.
Roll call, please.
Director Beckendorf?
Yes.
Director Pompella?
Yes.
Director Hines?
Aye.
Director Carter?
Aye.
Director Olson.
Yes.
I'd like to point out how the board president pauses to make sure that the recorder catches everything before moving on.
That's because I've been a secretary before for a board, so I know. Want to make sure she has the time.
A lot of little details.
To write things down. Just helps out a little bit.
It does, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. I've been in your shoes, so I understand. Like, frantically trying to get names. There are no moving on to action items.
Yeah.
Can I get a motion to approve item 10.1, disposition of district property?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion?
What are they going to do with it?
Ron, what are they going to do with the pads from the middle school? Disposition of district property.
Throw them away.
Sorry.
They're
old and yucky.
Well, they're old. Well, not only that, they don't provide the protection. So if they don't provide the protection, nobody's going to want them.
No.
Would you? Yeah.
not a whole lot of people, not a whole lot of districts want our hand-me-downs.
What?
Roll call, please.
Director Bickendorf?
Yes.
Director Kornfeller?
Yes.
Director Hines?
Aye.
Director Karcher?
Aye.
Director Olson?
Yes.
Did you answer?
She did.
Yes. Oh, okay.
She
said yes.
She is so quiet.
She's very quiet.
Yeah, girl.
She's close to the mic.
Sorry. I was concentrating on the next item. Can I get a motion to approve item 10.2, revised district calendar?
So moved.
Somebody probably make the motion.
Yeah, how do I say that?
So on December 17th, it will be a non-work, non-school day.
December 17th, non-work, non-school day. So moved.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion?
It's well-deserved across the board, not only for the teachers and the students, but the administration as well.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
very well-deserved.
Yeah, I did have an administrator say, does this apply to me?
Did you say no?
Yeah.
No, delivery. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
Sorry.
Roll call, please.
Before I say roll call, can I just say this is the last time I'm going to say Director Brickendorf?
It is.
And I got good at it,
you
right?
You got very good
okay.
at it.
Very quickly.
Oh,
very
right.
quickly. It is. And the last time you'll say Director Hines.
No. I know, but... Yours is the one I struggle with
the next
most.
Meeting to
oh, that's
swear
right.
in the board members and run
that's,
the president election.
That's
you can vote
right.
in it, but you'll do roll call and say
got it.
Yeah. All right. I'll proceed.
Thanks.
Director Benkendorf.
Yes.
Director Kornfeller.
Yes.
Director Hines.
Aye.
Director Karcher.
Aye.
Director Olson.
Yes.
Wow, we heard time. That.
That's the last time. That's the last time I'll say aye, though. There are no discussion items. BOE planning. Our next special board meeting is November 29th, 2021, and that is to swear in new board members and officer elections. And that will start at 6:30, right? And officer elections will start about 6:45. And I will, so you guys know, I will run the election. Heather's here for the president, and then whoever's elected the president. I will hit them in the head with the gavel over to them, and I'll go eat my cake, and you guys will proceed.
And
there'll be more cake, right?
M&M's. There is now.
I am all for sweets. For this.
See?
You know,
I'm not the only one.
So I'll take care of it.
And then we will post board participation at the Colorado Association of School Boards annual convention in Colorado Springs, which follows the special meeting to swear in the new board members, because there will be three or more board members present at that event, and it needs to be publicly posted, including the scheduled training from legal counsel. So that'll just get posted. That's the next, and then the next meeting is,
right.
I think, on the 13th.
And y'all's, not yours, y'all's next board meeting is December 13th. Y'all's.
So the 29th is at 6:30, right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And then the 13th is back to 6 o'clock.
Yes.
Right. And I sent you guys the meeting request at 6:30, just so it's on your calendars.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
There is no executive session. So I will, for the last time, adjourn this meeting at 9:08 p.m.